Retro Game Radio 2005. Keep it retro.
Hello, folks. Welcome to the September 2005 edition of Retro Gaming Radio. This is Shane R. Monroe, your host. Welcome to the program. Well, we do have an exciting show for you this month. We've got a super gigantic Bits and Bytes, thanks to all of the people who've been contributing all month. It's going to be a very busy segment. We are going to have a new editorial commentary, innovation. What is innovation? Till recently, I'm not sure even I knew what innovation is, but now I think I've got a pretty good idea, and I'd like to share my thoughts with you. We're also going to have a brand new CGE interview with Jerry Lawson. This guy was responsible for the hardware behind the Fairchild Channel F. Amazing guy to talk to, very dynamic dude. You're going to love him. We're also going to have an 8-bit flashback and all sorts of other good stuff right here this month on Retro Gaming Radio. During this month's editorial commentary, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about innovation. This may seem like I'm kind of straying from classic gaming, but trust me, I'll be tying this a lot into previous consoles and previous video game systems. But it occurred to me recently with the popularity of, say, the Nintendo DS and all of the good and bad press coming from the Nintendo Revolution controller announcement, that maybe it's time for us to take a good look at what innovation really is. Because I think that a lot of us, including myself, may have lost perspective on what innovation really is. As usual, I like to kind of go back through history and talk about how innovation has struck us upside the head before, maybe not totally recognizing it, and how it might apply to the future and who might take us there. In the early days, video games came out of arcades or locations where pinball was popular. Pinball, of course, started off in the bars, bowling alleys, places of recreation and entertainment. Unfortunately, a lot of people didn't like going to bars and a lot of people didn't like going to bowling alleys. And as the video game market began, these items started moving out of these, shall we say, more seedy establishments and moved into malls, into arcades, dedicated arcades, where they began to flourish. And the first step of innovation, and I want to start off by saying this before we even go into that if you look historically at what innovation was in our history of video games, you'll find that it almost always ties into a single premise: putting video games into the hands of the people. That's what innovation has been in the video game industry. And now that I've outlined that, let's continue. I just wanted to stop and break for that. The first thing that we saw was video games didn't have the kind of revenue they were hoping for because they were in locations that were traditionally hard to get to or excluded minors or, for whatever reason, did not get the games in the hands of the people. So they took the next step and they moved video games out of these marketplaces and into a more family-friendly environment. The Chuck E. Cheese, the Showtime pizza places, the places where more people could get their hands on the machines. And if you really stop and think about it, that's the first symbol of innovation: targeting an audience and getting the hands on the machines, the hands with the quarters, into the machines. So that was our first kind of step. We recognized where we needed to be, and we moved that direction. The next thing that came to pass is, kids were spending, and a lot of adults, let's be honest, were banging out tons and tons of cash into these games every week. Allowances, paper route money. Myself, I must have put at least half of my paper route money that I shouldn't have been spending into Dragon's Lair. And at the moment, there was no way to recreate that experience at home. So the first step was, let's get the hands of video games. Let's get the hands of the people onto these video games. How do we do that? We need to introduce it into a market that is not yet flourishing with video games. So they started bringing video games into the home. The Pongs, the Odysseys, the Fairchild Channel Fs, all the beginnings of the video game industry. If we can give them a similar experience at home, we can tap a market of people that don't have a lot of consumable cash, that has a repeat market base of consumable cash, and that these people will actually do something if they don't have to leave the house. So that market instantly, of course, exploded. The Atari 2600 probably is the best example, the VCS, of putting video games, popular video games, into the hands of the people. Sure, there were plenty of people before the 2600, but that's probably the springboard. Atari became synonymous with video games. I'm going to go home after school and play Atari. We've talked about this before in numerous shows. When you can actually take your trademark name and make everybody call it that, like Q-tips to cotton swabs, Frisbee to flying disc, Slinky to coiled spring toy. When you've managed to accomplish that, you've got a market that's going to make you millions and millions of dollars. So Atari did that. Atari brought video gaming into the home. Well, now that we had a huge market of people now playing video games, huge amounts of cash flow, lots of people banging on the doors, what was the next step? How do we further bring games into the hands of gamers? Well, it became apparent what gamers really wanted. They wanted the arcade at home experience. We've got video games at home, and they're fun. And Space Invaders is pretty cool. Asteroids is pretty cool, but let's be honest, this isn't the arcade game. It's close and it's fun, but I want the arcade experience at home. Well, even the television didn't really offer the arcade at home experience. It took somebody like Coleco to come up with the ColecoVision and immediately turn the marketplace into a feeding frenzy. The ColecoVision was selling so much mad fat product before the crash. It was insane. These guys could have gone the distance had the crash not occurred. ColecoVision was wild. And they actually packed the best game ever, the best home translation of Donkey Kong ever seen, was inside the box when you bought it. Now, how's that for taking the market by storm? Now, you can say, but there was Donkey Kong on a home video system before ColecoVision. That's not innovative. People who did not think the Atari was good enough, that segregated market of gamers who were still playing at the arcades because they wanted the arcade experience, those guys were now another set of hands to put on the video games. And Coleco knew it, and it was proven. You can't say, oh, well, you know, I guess it didn't really matter that Coleco had the best graphics and the best arcade experience. They sold gajillions of units. So we know that it worked, and we know that that marketplace was there. Then the crash came, right, and basically wiped video gaming off the planet. Now, this is a very interesting period of time. A lot of people think of the crash as a bad thing. A lot of times, we need a slap upside our heads to get things going right. We need to reboot our brain. We were in this huge feeding frenzy. Crappy games were being shoveled out by the truckloads. We had all these problems. And like they said in War Games, nature will find a way to just start over again. Well, the video game crash took care of that. And guess what happened as a result of the video game crash? Where did video gamers move to? Right? Where did video gamers actually move to after the video game crash? They moved to computers. Computers had that beautiful 3 or 4 years of time when computer gaming was extremely popular. And if you start looking at the foundations of all of our modern games, they all come from early PC gaming, the early 8-bit market. I mean, we had some amazing games back then, folks. Truly, truly amazing. games that would spawn similar titles, the Seven Cities of Gold, the Racing Destruction sets, all of the titles that we've talked about on the show. It's unbelievable what happened. If the crash had never happened, computers may never have taken off in terms of owning a piece of this video game market. And a lot of what we have now may still be immature. But the computing market showed them the way to making a rich, thick gaming experience. Not the 3-minute arcade game taken home, but an actual depth, the Temples of Apshai, the Wizardries, the Ultimas, some of the very deep, deep games that we had access to are all complements of the video game crash and what happened after it in terms of computing taking over. Then along came Nintendo, and everybody, even me, before I had a soft spot for Nintendo, even I could tell that, I could tell you that Nintendo was responsible for reviving the video game console market. The PC market was running games. There were games out. It's not like you couldn't play games anymore. You just had to have a $600 computer to do it. But Nintendo came over and said, look, we can teach you how to do this. We can show you how to create a system where you're not going to release crappy games. We're going to teach you how to market. We're going to teach you how to put video games back into the hands of the people. Because that's what you need. People don't trust you anymore. You release Pac-Man. People don't trust you anymore. You release DT. We show you how to do it. Right? And they did. They came over and reinvented the video game industry. And you know how they did it? They did it the same sort of way that ColecoVision did it, but they put a twist on it. If I were to say, give me your first thing that you remember about early Nintendo days, what would it be? Super Mario Brothers. What was tearing up what was left of the arcades at that point in time? Super Mario Brothers. And this wasn't a as good as could be done. This was like a perfect port. I mean, they actually brought a real arcade game home. For real. And people lost their minds. Duck Hunt. Yeah, remember Mario Duck Hunt combo cart? Right? They lost their minds over this stuff. And as a bonus, they said, you know what? Joystick's tired. You know, you guys have been cranking your hands on these little black discs. You've been cranking your thumbs on this 32 direction with this silvery disc thing. What's that all about? You've got crappy controllers that break every time you turn around. Look at what we got here. This little controller. It fits everybody's hands pretty well. And look at this. Look at this. They start slamming it against the wall. Look at this thing. It doesn't break. There's nothing to get caught on. And there's two buttons here, plus two more that we can use. Look at this. The D-pad, which I've never figured out because it doesn't look anything like a D. But a D-pad with two buttons. Look at that. And they innovated. They brought a new controller. They brought actual arcades into the home. And they brought a methodology, a marketing system that worked. 8-point Nintendo check. We're going to make sure that every game that goes out the door, you, Mr. Consumer, look at me. No more crappy games, I promise. In fact, you see this little seal down here in the corner, this Nintendo seal of quality? First, we're going to ass rape all the developers with this, but here's the good part for you. You don't care about us ass raping the developers, right? No? Okay, good. Listen, we're going to ass rape the developers, but don't worry about that. That seal means that you're not going to get burned again. You're not going to get another E.T. We promise. And they kept their word. And Nintendo, the NES became, you know, arguably one of the best-selling consoles of all time ever. Of course, then, after that, we got the Sega Master System. We got all these guys popping back up again. But it took Nintendo to bring us out of the rut. Then along came that generation jump. Right, we had the Sega Genesis, and the Genesis was, a lot of people say, well, Super Nintendo was better. You know what? Genesis redefined how to market. Genesis brought the concept of the franchise really into public view. You cannot fault Genesis for not innovating. They brought the concept of the franchise, Sonic the frickin' Hedgehog. They brought this guy into fruition. If you start looking at everybody that copied the Sonic the Hedgehog model after that, franchising, you want to see the same people over and over again. You want to see basically the same game over and over again, right? Well, we're going to provide that to you through franchising. And they sold a bajillion units doing that. And you know what? Technically, it was inferior to the Super Nintendo. But everybody had a Genesis. For crying out loud, I had a Genesis. That says a lot, considering I was still a PC or a computer boy back then. So Genesis taught us again that video gaming is once again a popular market, and that we can use franchises to keep people interested in the market. Sometimes it's not a matter of getting new people to come in. It's keeping the attrition rate down. Genesis proved that we can release more or less the same game, one after the other, and as long as there's a little bit different about it, you're going to buy it again. The sport games on the Genesis, that invented almost engine whoring right there. But it set a paradigm, and it paved the way, I should say, for the future video game markets to continue. That's innovation. You don't have to like it to know that it's innovative, right? It could not be your cup of tea. I cannot stand the concept that there were like 17 billion John Madden footballs released, but it worked. And it kept the industry alive and going. Sometimes you got to shear the sheep to feed the cows. You know what I'm saying? So what happened then? We had the Genesis. We had that weird moment in time where like the Philips CDI came out and the Sega CD, and everybody was trying to make that one technological jump. Saturn, Jag, none of these things really they were reaching for it, but nobody could innovate out of the box. Everybody was trying to use technology to innovate, right? Sega CD, look at CD! I can put movies on your video! That's innovative! Well, that's the problem. It was not innovative. If it was innovative, it would have worked. The problem was we had the hardware. We had the Sega CD. Okay, so it was 64 colors. So what? You can do cool things with 64 colors. Ask any old Amiga programmer. But the problem was the software. I love Night Trap, and I love Double Switch, and I'm like one of five on the planet, okay? It's far be it for me to say that the Night Trap was innovative, okay? Maybe it wasn't. But the synergy between the hardware and the software was not there. The Saturn, right? Sort of the same deal. The Jaguar, definitely the same deal. I don't care how many times you pump dual 32 bits to 64 bits. It didn't work. The software wasn't there. The lineup, the synergy was not there to make that happen. It took Sony and Nintendo to break through the next generational barrier to innovate. And, you know, if you were to ask me maybe a year ago who broke the generational gap, I would tell you it was Sony PlayStation. But the more I go back and look, a lot of things owe themselves to the Nintendo 64. Not a Nintendo 64 fan, never owned one. The only game that I liked really on Nintendo 64 was the game that everybody hates, which is Mario Kart 64. I love the 3D tracks. I don't care if the computer cheated. End of story. Now, what the Nintendo 64 did give us was the introduction of the analog control. It gave us the introduction of rumble. It gave us the introduction of 3D platforming. So, and to say that Sony PlayStation, which obviously turned out to be the victor here, since you can still go out to buy one right now, new, on the street, and still buy a PlayStation 1, Sony won. But you cannot stop at the concept that the DualShock controller, which to me still is the epitome of the best controller out there, analog controllers, rumble, these things all Nintendo gave us. Nintendo failed to get the synergy between the software and the hardware fast enough. PlayStation, Sony came up and said, here's how we're going to win this market. We're going to make every game for everybody. There's going to be a catalog of so many freaking titles for this platform, everybody's going to have something to play. Nintendo played it safe and said, look, you know, we're going to stick with our Mario, we're going to stick, you know, we're working on this wave race thing. Timing was off. Timing was totally off. So, N64 fell by the wayside, but you cannot deny Nintendo's ability to innovate. Now, while we're in the same sort of time frame, we got to go back just a little bit. I don't want to skip past this. As I've said before, the proper methodology for innovation is to put more games in the hands of more gamers. Nintendo said, okay, we've rebuilt the marketplace over here. You know, we're not the number one box anymore. We got Genesis kicking our ass. We got all this going on. So we need to innovate again. Because if we continue innovating, we're going to continue to make money while everyone else catches up. So Nintendo came out with the Game Boy. Incredibly successful handheld. Now, they've been making Game & Watches. They've been watching the market. You got your Tommy Blips. You've got your handheld AD&D games. People like to have handheld video games or portable video games. But unfortunately, as always, there's a struggle to make the home versions as good as the arcade versions, as good as the versions that they're coming from. Couldn't be done with Game & Watch. You know? Couldn't be done. Couldn't be done with LED electronics. The Entek Pac-Man game may have been cool, but it wasn't Pac-Man. Let's be honest. So, Nintendo said, okay, let's create a unit. It hasn't got to be technologically advanced. Okay? Let's make a unit that's like our Game & Watch. People like the Game & Watch. The liquid crystal display thing works out okay. Let's keep our costs low. We'll port our standard D-pad and button combo, which made us famous. And we'll take all of these games that people now know from Nintendo, and let's bring them on to a handheld, a cartridge-based handheld. And let's find the hottest game ever to pack with it. And they came up with Tetris, right? Arguably the absolute best game of Tetris ever made was on the Game Boy, right? It introduced the first linked play on the handheld. It's unbelievable, right? People lost their minds about this. Once again, Nintendo innovated to put more games in the hands of more gamers. Gamers that wouldn't regularly pay for a console. Nintendo's plan, grand plan, whether this is on paper or not, I don't know. I'm telling you what I believe Nintendo's plan is. Nintendo's plan is to continue absorbing gamers that aren't already swayed by a brand or model. If you look traditionally at what Nintendo's done over the years, that's kind of what they're up to. That's definitely what they're up to now. Bringing in different types of games and different ideas to continue to absorb the market that doesn't already exist. If you're not competing with Sony and Microsoft, you're not having to worry about losing customers to them. Am I right? If you're not in direct competition with a company, their customer base is not your problem. Nintendo knows this. Nintendo knows that while the market is huge and there's more people playing video games now more than ever, there are still a larger population of people who are not. That's where innovation comes into play. Innovation is bringing more hands to more video games. So after the PlayStation 1, let's be honest, there hasn't been any innovation. Right? Really, let's be honest. There's been no innovation. We've had newer consoles with better graphics, with basically the same controls. Even the beloved Dreamcast, as much as I love it, there's not a lot of innovation going on. There's a lot of soul, a lot of spirit, great games, beautiful hardware. Not a lot of innovation going on. You can call Shenmue innovation. It's not. Innovation is not just software. It's hardware. It's a synergy between the two that has to be executed just right to make it work. That's how innovation works out. It can't be bought. Innovation has to happen. And everything has to line up like the tumblers in a lock. All right? Now let's look at what the last piece of innovation was, really, which is the Nintendo DS. You know how you can tell innovation in the works? The first thing out of people's mouth is gimmick. Gimmick. Touchscreen gimmick. Microphone gimmick. Blowing on the screen gimmick. Gimmick, 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 gimmick. That's how you know innovation's happening. The first thing out of their mouths is gimmick. It's the first thing out of everybody's mouth with the Revolution controller. I'll be honest with you. I looked at the Revolution controller, and I'm like, damn, Nintendo's lost their minds. They just gave me a DVD remote. And then I started thinking about it and talking to the guys at work. And we generated this foaming at the mouth thing going on at work about all the crap you could do. Look at the Nintendo controller. All right? They managed to put in look where they fall back to every time. D-pad and two buttons. D-pad, two buttons. Except for this time we have motion control. Now don't be thinking that's a gimmick, folks. Don't be thinking that's a gimmick. Everything. If you watch that Nintendo video, I'll try to post a link, showing people sword fighting with the remote, showing people conducting music with the remote, showing people smacking flies with the remote. I'm going to take it a step further. What if you strap one of those remotes to your head? You now have mouse look. You can be playing a first-person shooter and actually be able to turn your head up, down, left, and right and change the view on the screen. Imagine not just sword fighting with a controller, but taking another controller and Velcroing it to your arm, your forearm or your other arm. You now have a shield. You can actually do combat with this thing. I'll take you another step further. Take the Revolution controllers and Velcro them to your ankles. A pair of them, one on each foot. What does that give you? Running. Jumping. Oh, Dance Dance Revolution without a freaking pad. All right? I hate the Dance Dance Revolution pads. They suck. You got to pay like $100 to get one that's any good. No more pad. DDR anywhere. Huh? This goes on and on, folks. You can sit here and talk all day about everything that you can do with a Revolution controller. Now, you can sit back and scream, gimmick, 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 all day long. I'm telling you right now, this is only one half of the innovation. Hardware is just the beginning. There is a synergy coming. If the software can be unleashed and exploited to work with that piece of hardware, the Revolution will be the absolute console to have. You will be able to, it's as close to VR as you're going to get without a prescription from your doctor. You are not going to be able to get closer. What is VR? Everyone, VR is the future, right? VR is the only thing that's going to pull us out of the slump of better graphics. I mean, look at this. I don't care how many billions of times more powerful the Xbox 360 is. We ain't seeing any innovation. We're seeing the same controller. We're seeing the same games. We're seeing a higher polygon count. This goes for the PS3 too, folks. Okay? This is not innovation. This is progress. You expect things to get better over time. That's progress. Innovation is taking it in another direction that you didn't see coming. And that's what Nintendo's going to do. Historically, they've proven they can do it. Right? The Nintendo DS, especially now with the crop of games that's available. Granted, as an early adopter, I enjoy the tech demos. But now, Castlevania, Pack and Roll, Kirby's Canvas Curse, the list goes on and on about how much fun you can have with just a slight variation of a Game Boy Advance, right? Basically. They're proving it can be done, right? My money's on Nintendo to innovate. Now, I'm not saying that Microsoft and Sony ain't going to make a mad fat load bucket of cash and Nintendo's going to sit number three. I'm not saying that's not going to be the way it's going to work, because that is how it's going to work. Because there's, if you were to break down the gaming market right now, most of the gaming market wants the standards. The standard 12-button controller, the standard first-person shooter, the standard sport game. They just want it with better graphics, better sound, high definition, and 5.1 surround. That's all they want. And they're happy with that. The diehard gamers, which always represent a smaller demographic, but don't you let this not bite you in the ass. The Revolution will bring in non-gamers. If you watch that video, you see grandparents, old people, conducting music. That doesn't sound exciting to you at all. Doesn't sound exciting to me, let's be honest. But this is how they're going to do it. This is how they're going to sneak right in under the radar and become more profitable than Sony and Microsoft are in the gaming market. They don't care about you, Sony and Microsoft. Nintendo does not care about you or your audience. You have Nintendo knows there are Sony fanboys, there are Microsoft fanboys. They cannot be swayed. The fact that people have already paid off their Xbox 360 on pre-order without ever seeing a unit in operation says volumes to Nintendo. We cannot help you, people. You obviously like what you already had last year. We can't help you. We're not even going to try to help you. Instead, we are going to take the innovative route. We're going to give you what you do not have. And I'm telling you, that's the way the future is going to ride, folks. Innovation. Innovation. The synergy between the software and the hardware with a little bit of good sense wrapped up in between to bind them together. That's what's going to cause the biggest ripple in video gaming. And I truly believe that Nintendo's the only people right now that have the ability to bring it to us. Innovation through history is not really hard to see if you sit back and look at it. And you sit back and think, what were we doing and how did we innovate? We didn't innovate by bumping up the specs of the machines. We innovated by changing our thought paradigm. We innovated by changing the way we do things. Not by staying the same and throwing more horsepower onto it. That's not how we've progressed. That's not how we're going to progress in the past or in the future. Look at the past, progress into the future. Don't look at yesterday. Look at last year. Look at last decade. Look at the last 20 years. You'll see what it takes to innovate, to move forward. You know, it's not like the revolution's not going to have a decent graphic engine. It's not like you're going to have to play 2600 games with this innovative new controller. It's going to be clean. It's going to be backward compatible. It's going to have the sort of things, it's going to have the access to the vast Nintendo library, not for free, but it's going to have access to this vast library of classic games that people might want to play. It's classic gamers aren't going to get left out. I'm telling you, that's the way to do it. Now, is this a guaranteed recipe for success? Abso-frickin-lutely not. Right? The Virtual Boy, right? The 3D red thing? The hell. Right? That's Nintendo's attempt to innovate and fail. Variety of reasons. But the synergy wasn't there. Synergy wasn't there at all. So, just look ahead. Don't discount what Nintendo's doing. Don't rush off and buy a 360 right away. Don't rush off and pre-order a PlayStation 3. I'm telling you, you gotta keep an eye on Nintendo. You gotta keep an eye on what's going on with the Nintendo DS. You've gotta keep an eye on the innovators. Right? Because innovators is where the next good stuff's going to come from. Sure, it'll be copied, right? I cite the browser wars. IE still ain't figured out how to innovate yet. Opera came along and innovated. They came up with all this cool stuff. They imported into their browser, made it work. Firefox came along and snatched all the good stuff up. Third-party IE browser people like Crazy Browser, Avant, crying out loud. One of them even said, we are the Opera for IE, right? That's how you know that you're innovating. People are copying you, and people are actually using your name as a reference. We are the Opera. We're Opera IE. Come on now. What's that all about? So just because Opera's the number three browser, hell, maybe it's the number four browser. Who cares? These are the people who are innovating. If you want to see the latest cool browser technology, you don't go to IE. You don't go to Firefox even. Their extensions came from Opera. Okay? There's some extensions that aren't in Opera that are available for Firefox, whatever. But let's be honest, the stuff that really matters all originated from Opera. So let's look at it this way. Whose team do you want to be on? The innovators or the copiers? You know? You know me. You guys have been listening to me for 7 years. 2 years ago, I would have told you that Nintendo lost their minds and that Nintendo sucks because I did not like early Nintendo. I didn't. 2 years ago, I would have spat in Nintendo's direction, but I feel deep down in the gut of my soul that Nintendo's the only people left that are innovating, right? Who knows? But I thought it was a good time. This is a good time. This is the beginning of the season, brand new season of Retro Radio. We got tons of good stuff ahead. Even if you're not looking for the unique experience, there's still cool stuff coming, right? I mean, we got the GP2X coming, which is the open source, basically the open source portable handheld. There's tons of good stuff coming. Sony PlayStation Portable still has a chance. I think Sony's screwing themselves royally, but what do I know? Right? I think they're screwing all the developers. I think they're screwing everybody except for themselves. But what do I know? Right? There's cool stuff coming. Who knows? Maybe the Xbox 360 and the PlayStation 3 will actually come up with something cool, something innovative. Doubt it, but it could happen. Depends on how much market Nintendo takes. If Nintendo gets popular, then they'll steal. Until then, they can be satisfied with the market they already have, their built-in market. Anyway, I've ran this editorial commentary long enough. It's been a while since we've had a really good long one, so I figured I'd get a good one in here. And this is the perfect time. And it's something that's near and dear to my heart right now. So anyway, so that's going to wrap it up for the editorial commentary. Let's get on with the rest of the show. We still have a great interview. We got 8-bit flashback, got the bits and bytes, big show. Let's move on. Just a quick mention about the Year 6 DVD-ROM. It's finally shipping. We sold 50-something copies, I guess, right off the bat for pre-orders. Good stuff. Everything has been shipped. Everyone is getting them in the mail, even as the show is airing here this month. Sorry for the delay, but everyone seems to think that the delay was worth it. I happen to agree. I think it turned out exceptional, and I'm glad I spent the extra time on it and did it right. Tons of stuff, of course, for those of you who have not yet listened to an archive DVD-ROM. It's a full year of shows and a full year of interviews. Most of them are uncut. We did lose a few of them this year with Brian's death, but we did pretty good. Tons of bloopers, tons of extra content, lots of stuff with me and Brian jamming about classic games, playing games. That's just great stuff. There's just tons and tons and tons of content. Lots of pictures, some video clips this year. All good on the Year 6 DVD-ROM. Available and shipping now. Retro Gaming Radio for $24.95. That's how, this is the only way we support the show. We don't take advertisers. We don't take sponsors. This is how we get enough cash together to make ends meet, go to the show, do that sort of thing. So this is pretty much our only source of income. And so we like to make sure that our listeners get a good deal when they pick this stuff up. So enough about that. Year 6 DVD at RetroGamingRadio.com. This month we have sort of an 8-bit flashback for the Commodore 64. I'd like to talk about a few of the stupendous demonstrations of Commodore 64 coolness. This doesn't really have a particular name, mind you. These are just a few of the things that when I think back to the Commodore 64, these are the things that really laid an impression down on me. So I don't know if you'd actually call this a flashback, but I was thinking about this stuff. I was like, man, I really want to share this, so I'm going to. Some of the cool things about the Commodore 64, of course, were the VIC chip, the SID chip for making unbelievable music, and somehow there was just an amazing amount of creativity flowing from Commodore 64 people. And some of this stuff you may remember, some of it you may not remember, but trust me, it all happened, folks. I just don't make this stuff up. One of the earliest memories of the Commodore 64 that I have of something that blew me away so much that it burned an imprint into my psyche was from, There was a program, a BBS program, sort of like Procom, maybe. You can call it Procom for the Commodore 64. It was called Sixth Sense. It was terminal software, okay? That's kind of what they used to call it. Anyway, you'd use that to log into BBSs and things. And the guy that made it was Rick Sterling. And I remember because it was such a great piece of software. Best ever terminal package. Unbelievable. Piece of software I actually bought back on the 64. But anyway, Rick also dabbled in music. And it turned out that he had created a demo of the ragtime song The Entertainer. And what made this interesting is it took 3.5 minutes to compile. Basically, it actually, I don't know exactly what happened. I was pretty young at the time, and I don't remember much about what I saw other than the fact that it was amazing and it took three and a half minutes to run. But it said something about populating arrays, so it must have been building this amazing chart of music inside its little brain. And when the music started, it was the most impressive rendition of The Entertainer I've ever heard. Outside of an actual piano. It was totally amazing. The synthesis was great. I never could get a hold of another copy of that, but I remember it was worth the 3 minutes. And what was funny is, I don't remember if you could play it again. Seems to me you had to wait 3.5 minutes each time to play it, so I ended up having to record it to tape just so I could listen to the stupid thing, without having to wait 3.5 minutes. It was amazing. If anybody actually has that kicking around, I'd love to hear it again to see if I just lost my mind or if it was really cool. It occurred to me at that point in time, though, that this was definitely a unique computer and had a lot of spirit and a lot of soul. What can I tell you? Next up on the list is a program that's actually a combination of two other programs. Sounds creepy. The program that I'm talking about is called Swinth. It was a cross between the Swish demo and the Synth demo. The Swish demo was a Commodore 64 rendition of Kicks, basically. They had a line that would travel across the screen and leave a trail behind it. It would change colors. I think there's a Microsoft screensaver that does something similar. But to see your Commodore 64 kick that out, there were tons of options you could make the line. long, short, random, color shifting, how long you wanted the tail to be. You can have all this cool stuff, all these settings that you could do with it. And it was cool. Then somebody came out with Synth, which was maybe 7 or 8 songs. There were, I mean, some of them you actually recognize, like Tubular Bells. But there was like, there's probably, they're all famous, but I didn't know them at the time, of course. I was a kid. But one of them was Enola Gay from Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark, which is really funny. I have a weird love affair with Enola Gay, Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark, because of that demo. I would have never gotten into OMD had I not heard that demo, and I would have never seen or heard the billions of renditions, remixes, recaptures, rescratched versions of Enola Gay. So it's kind of interesting that something so far back can have a consistent impact over and over again. I've had mod versions, SID versions, MP3s, trance mixes, dance mixes. I've had a Sash versus OMD version. So it's kind of interesting to see how that comes up. But I remember it leaving an impression on me, and this was one of the things that I would do if I was doing homework or I was reading or something. I would put Swinth on, and Swinth took Synth and Swish, combined them into the same thing so you could listen to all this cool music while you were watching this cool visual demo. Okay, glorified screensaver, but this is like, you know, 1982. What do you want? Very cool stuff. And I still have that kicking around here somewhere. Every now and then I'll throw it up because it still has some great renditions of the music. So that was another demo that really, really hit me home. And these aren't like these weird mega demo team coder things. These were just, I don't know. They weren't competitive. They were just, somebody was goofing around and made something cool. I love that. It was just, it's something you don't see anymore. Everything's about making money, getting bought by Microsoft, whatever. There's nothing that really jumps out that says, I was just dicking around and look at this. This is cool. The next thing I remember from the Commodore 64 that really, really hit me home, and it took me forever to find another copy of this thing, and I'm not even sure if I've still got it. I've got to have it somewhere. At the local department store, Sears, JCPenney's, everybody sold Commodore 64s. You couldn't walk into a department store without tripping over stacks of Commodore 64s. In the store, every now and then, Commodore would send them some, you know, junket kit for the holidays. And in one of the junket kits was this demo. It was a Christmas demo. It was Happy Holidays from Commodore. And it had probably 5 or 6 scenes in it. They were all made out of Commodore graphics. You know those graphics you could make by holding down the Commodore key and picking different letters? So out of rudimentary boxes, circles, squares, all this stuff, they actually built very nice-looking graphic scenes from, like, you know, a church, a house, Christmas tree, and it played amazing audio renditions of popular Christmas carols. But probably the most impressive of all of the parts of that demo, was at the beginning of the demo, the Commodore logo would come up, and this wind would start blowing, and all of a sudden, little flecks of snow started falling. And then it got a little heavier and a little heavier. And the next thing you knew, the snow started accumulating on the bottom of the screen. It started getting accumulating on top of the Commodore symbol. And frankly, it was amazing to see this. I mean, it was, of course, it's nothing now, but to look back and go, man, that was so cool, the way the snow was piling up and everything. Truly amazing. So that was like the Commodore Happy Holidays demo, something to that effect. Last couple of demos I want to talk about. This, I'm not going to make this segment run a long time. We've had so much to talk about already this month. But the next couple of things were game demos that never made it. And some of these demos have more interesting history than demos. The first demo, which actually did make it into a game, was something called Saucer Attack. A lot of people might remember Saucer Attack. It was originally done as a demonstration to show off the graphics capabilities and graphic talents of Jim Sox. And he created this demo of, you know, the White House being destroyed by a UFO. And they managed to parlay that into some sort of a game. But to me, while it was kind of an okay game, to me it was really a technical demo showing that how a Commodore 64 could have basically Amiga graphics. I mean, if you look at a screenshot, it looks like Amiga graphics. It's that clean. But more interesting was the other title I wanted to talk about, which was something that, as far as I know, never got finished, and it was technologically amazing all on its own. It was something called Time Crystal. And the concept here was, is you fly this time machine back in time into the dinosaur days, and you got out of the time machine, and you could, you know, go on this quest, find the time crystal, whatever. You never got that far, because that's as far as the demo went. The game had, demo had unbelievable graphics. I mean, you'd look at this and go, holy crap, I can't believe a Commodore 64 pushed this out. It's one of those games that you can't look at a screenshot, though. It's one of those products you can't say, look at the screen and go, man, that looks great. You've got to see how you could, the time machine itself was amazing. It was 3D. Literally, it was pseudo-3D, of course, because there was no 3D back then. But it was so good that you could zoom the time machine all the way back into the screen until it became a little tiny dot, and then zoom it all the way up to the front of the screen, where it was huge. And you could land it. That was part of the deal. You could land it, but as soon as you landed it, the game was over, or the demo was over. What I found stunning about this is the product actually absorbed every single byte of Commodore 64 memory. In fact, it actually rewrote some of the temporary scratch data areas of the Commodore 64 in order to pull just this demo off. There was no way you could do a soft reset. You know, one of those little reset buttons you had wired up to your 64? That alone would not restore your 64. You physically had to shut it off and bring it back up, power it back up, in order to rebuild these scratch areas that the Commodore 64 used for its own operating system. Totally fascinating stuff. I mean, and it looked amazing. I probably have a copy of that kicking around somewhere, too. They released that. It was pretty widespread. Anybody who has seen Time Crystal knows what I'm talking about. As I recall, Time Crystal actually did get finished on the Amiga, and it got put out, but it wasn't as amazing to see the Amiga kick out this sort of pseudo-3D as it was to see a Commodore 64 with, you know, 38,000 bytes free pumping this thing out. So there's a lot of cool stuff on the old 8-bit platforms. I'm sure Atari 800 people have similar stories to tell. But I wanted to take just a quick minute this episode, because I haven't really talked about some of the 8-bit stuff in a while. And I like to get back to the basics every now and then. So write in on the forums some of the experiences you've had with old Commodore 64 demos and graphics. I'll have another one I want to talk to you about next month. It's pretty cool. And I actually do have a copy of this one kicking around. It took me forever to even remember what it was called. But we'll talk about that next month. Let's get on with the rest of the show. This month we're going to talk to Jerry Lawson from the Classic Gaming Expo 2005. Jerry probably was the pioneer of almost everything you know of video game hardware. One of the main developers, the Fairchild Channel F, that quirky but very cool cartridge-based system from the late 70s. We've talked about it on the show. Jerry's a much more dynamic person to talk about the Fairchild Channel F than I am. So let's get ready to listen to Jerry Lawson. Okay, this is Shane R. Monroe at the Classic Gaming Expo 2005, San Francisco, California. I'm here with Jerry Lawson, the man of the Fairchild Channel F.
Uh-huh.
Also, the programmer of Amiga games, which, of course, all of you know, as my listeners know, that I'm just about ready to lose my mind right now. Not only Channel F, but the Amiga as well. Jerry, welcome. I don't even know where to start. Tell us about your involvement with Channel F.
Well, at the beginning, I can tell the involvement in video games per se. My background was mainly I was a hardware design engineer, and I worked in video displays and computer interface, that sort of thing. I joined Fairchild in 71. I became their first field application engineer. And I used to call on customers in the Bay Area and help them with designs and application problems for semiconductor products. Along about that time, I was talking to a couple of companies that the microprocessor was about ready to rear its ugly head. But the consensus by most people was that it wasn't going to be fast enough to do video. And I said, ridiculous. It is fast enough. I said, first of all, you don't do video at dot rate clock times. You do it at frame rate.
Right.
And then the frame rate is very slow, particularly if you use a buffer memory and load that memory with data. You
sure.
Got plenty of time.
Plenty of time.
Plenty of time. And to prove it out, I started building one in my garage. But I incorporated other things, and since we're going to use... There she is.
It's you.
That's you. Wait a minute. I got something for you.
That's my main girl that delivered a Commodore 64 on a chip so I can play it on my TV and not scream about how bad Jumpman is.
You got to find Dave.
Are you going to interview now?
You know what? You can interview my interview. Interrupt my interview anytime. Do you need something
right now? There's two cameras I wanted to give you to take a look at.
Oh, okay. Are the ones that you need the sync generator for?
No, I wanted to find out what they are.
Oh, okay.
You see Dave around here as soon as you find him?
I'm here all day, so...
Oh, okay. We'll find... I don't know about tomorrow, but okay. But he's got them here now, somewhere. Okay.
I might have to run back to my place and grab that sync generator for you.
Oh, where? It's back at your place.
Well,
now, you know, I think I'm a smart guy until I get around her, and it's just I'm just completely lost.
I've got two exits up, is where I'm staying, but...
All right.
I want to make sure I get that to you.
Oh, okay.
Okay,
Jerry. All right, as we were saying, where were we?
You were talking about building the video processor in your garage.
Oh, yeah. Well, we built a game with an RGB 25-inch monitor called Demolition Derby. The sound was all digitized.
Yeah.
The hand controllers were all digitized. The whole idea of it was I was out to make a non-destructible coin-op game. And that
interesting.
That was because... too many problems were occurring with using pots and joystick switches.
Sure.
That were being wrecked.
Right. Oh, yeah. Tons of maintenance.
Okay. So what I was trying to do was to come up with... I had optically encoded devices where no moving parts touched each other. So it was the idea to get away from having wear out.
This is optical. So this is in the 70s? Man. Way ahead of time.
We even had a function that in the coining mechanism... we timed the time that the coin would drop down to contact the switch.
Right.
And we programmed what we call coin control. So if a kid tried to stick something down there and hit the switch, he wouldn't buy it.
So let me paraphrase this. So basically you were in the anti-vagrancy department is what you were looking at. You were looking at keeping people from breaking your stuff and keeping people from ripping you off.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating. I mean, you don't even think about stuff like that, but somebody's got to do that stuff.
Yeah, well, that was the appeal of having a processor in the game.
Sure.
That all that was possible through programming as a secondary function.
It's totally fascinating. I would have never thought about that.
Yeah. So I said, this is what the processor would bring to putting it in the game. And then the secondary point was that you change the skins and put ROMs in place to put in new programs. So when you brought out a new game, you took the same basic framework, changed some graphics on it, stuck in some new ROMs, and you had a brand new game.
And you designed all this.
Yeah.
I'm not even worthy of sitting here. I'm going to leave.
What?
No, I'm sorry. I'm not worthy. That's amazing. I mean, that's like the basic architecture of everything you see here. You're the man. Okay, now you're going to have to explain to me what happened to the Fairchild Channel left, though, but we'll get to that. Keep going.
Okay.
He's hiding from me.
Hey, Dave, could you get... I saw Jerry.
Oh, he did? Okay.
He's around here.
Is this your water?
Yeah, thanks. Well, that's another one.
Right. You never can have too much water.
No, I can't have, you know. But I'm going to pull it out again, okay?
Yeah, you just rent water.
You rent it.
Yeah, you rent it.
Yeah. Yeah, so as far as the Fairchild Channel F, this became known that I was doing this in my garage.
Yeah.
In fact, me and my team finished the game and actually put it in the field in a pizza parlor in Campbell.
It's always a pizza bar. It's always a pizza place that gets the stuff.
We never pushed it any further, and by that time, Fairchild wanted me to work on something for them.
I bet. Want to get out some of that cash.
Okay. So I switched over to doing that, and working in conjunction with another company called Alpex that had been working on it with the 8080 microprocessor.
Sure.
And my contribution was to switch it over to the FA.
Yeah, of course.
All right. But what happened was we arrived at some wonderful goals that we were very proud of. We were the first complex electronics function that ever got through the FCC.
Really?
I mean, we had a nightmare of conditions we had to meet. See, people don't realize that when you add a modulator, RF modulator, to make it a home game, per se.
Right.
you fall in line with the FCC because it's a transmitter producing power and transmitting a signal on channel 3.
Right, right. Yeah.
But that's not why they fail or have difficulty. Actually, it is all the logic in the machine will not pass the FCC. That's true today.
Huh.
You take a PC.
Yeah.
And turn it on in a normal environment,
right,
it will fail the FCC. And the FCC specifications in that year were 10 times worse than they are now. They loosened them up.
Really?
Yeah. See, what happened was people like TI said, you can't do that, raised objection to it. The FCC would bring you into a position, here's what was happening. Actually, right now, the law that they have in place, there are electric shavers that won't pass the test. But that's not, what happens is that you go and act and, well, I'm putting in this RF power source, this RF transmitter, so I need their approval. You take it down to them, the transmitter, the RF section, passed. No problem. But the radiation that was coming from the logic would not pass. Okay? And they get you for conducted, radiated, all these frequencies got nothing to do with the modulator. You take the modulator out, it wouldn't pass.
Right.
Apple was kind of sneaky.
No way.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Say it's not true.
They did it. What they did was, when they first came out, they couldn't pass the test. They didn't even try.
What, for like the Apple II?
What they did was, they never included the modulator. If you ever remember, they used to say, buy this kit, put this together, and you connect it.
Oh, that is sneaky.
It's the same kind of rule that was used years ago to say, you know, I got this machine gun. God, that's illegal.
But you take off the automatic clip on it.
No, it's not automatic. But I can buy the kit. And the kit costs $50. That's not illegal.
Well, switchblades were like that, weren't they? Switchblade knives. You could buy the kit.
Yeah.
Right.
And if I put it together, it's illegal.
Is that really why every one of the early consoles had an external RF modulator?
Yes.
The ColecoVision had one internal.
Yeah, because they went and got the test done.
Man, that's cool. See, this is totally amazing. I had no idea.
Yeah, yeah. That's why I did it. And, you know, and it's funny. It wasn't fair because the people that tried to do it the right way.
Right.
They got shot down. Trying to do it. And what happened was we've had some instances where we fail a couple of times. And what the test is, you sat there and I tried to talk to the FCC about, well, how do you conduct your test? And man, voodoo was cleaner. All right? And they would come around and they would take the darn game and stick it down and throw the wires around this way and take a stick and stir it. And I'm sitting there going, could you give me the equation of the stick and the stir? Because I'd like to, you know, work on this, you know? And they were going, well, you know, I said, oh, gee, that's cool, right?
Oh, man. And they haven't changed much today.
Oh, well, they've changed much in the state that they have outside people do it now that
right.
are certified, okay? In fact, I found myself in
that's
recent
important.
Years still taking stuff and getting it approved.
Right.
And redesigning it so it will pass.
Yeah.
But it was a trick. They did some things that were rather interesting, okay? And but they try to impress you about the importance of what they do.
Of course, they just find a paycheck.
Yeah, yeah. And I didn't fight them on that. I said, oh, okay, you know, sure, you guys are important. You know,
you're important.
You're important. You know,
I'll touch you.
Yeah, that's good. You know, you're important. And you make sure everybody else has to go through this.
That's right. Yeah, if you're going to do it to me, you better be doing it to
everybody.
And him.
And then what happened is that during the middle of this darn thing, they made a ruling that used to cost a couple $1,000s for an application. They made a ruling, oh, you can't do that. They took it away, the fees. And I said, okay, where's my money?
Where do I apply for my refund?
I want a refund. Oh, no.
It was like a 1,000
right?
pass or fail, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, right, right.
Oh, man. So it wasn't just a matter of if you pay a grand if you pass. Every time you went in, they,
thousand.
Nope, not for you, and then you paid them grand.
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah.
Tight.
Yep. And you know, then there was like your next problem was like UL.
Yeah, when UL, did UL kick into that. Things? That was like in the middle of the 70s?
Yeah, well, UL had a different deal. One of the reasons that we had a transformer separate.
Yeah, I've always wondered that,
110
too.
Plugged into it?
Yeah.
110 was, hey, bad news.
Some kid can electrocute himself?
That's a kid could stick his tongue in the circuit board, you know, the whole works, right? So they didn't want that, right? It's okay. So we put a transformer outside with low voltage. You think that would solve the problem? Not altogether. The other problem was when you started to make more and more current available, you had a bigger and bigger wall unit.
Right.
So then there was a moment of force of how much pressure you put on the outlet.
Oh.
Because if it was real heavy, you know, if you look in some people's houses, the power outlet is the most ragged thing in their home.
Sometimes you ain't got a faceplate on it.
Right. And you put a wall transformer on, and the darn thing was got a moment of force of yank it out of the wall. They couldn't have that, right? So, no, that's not a good deal. Well, they wanted UL approval on the transformer. However, you didn't have to have UL approval on the system. You had to have UL approval on the transformer.
On the transformer. Okay. Yeah, gotcha.
Now, the second part of that was in L.A. County, if you didn't have UL approval and CSA approval, you couldn't sell a game in L.A. County. Oh, it is. Well, you didn't know that, huh?
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, that's true.
They I continue to be upset.
Had to have approval.
Wow.
And they could come in and say, for instance, outside of L.A. County, you could sell it. But you couldn't sell it in L.A. County. They had to have approval.
So everyone but L.A. County got Fairchild's.
No, we finally got their approval.
I got to hear the way you got around it, though.
We didn't really get around it.
You just
had, we got it where we had approval, CSA.
Right.
But and each one of the countries had their little deals, too. Like in Germany has a group called Bundespost, which is the equivalent of FCC in Germany.
Gotcha.
Each country had their own little idiosyncrasy. Most of the time, if you pass America, you got a rubber stamp.
Nice.
Sometimes you didn't. Okay. But we had built games for Germany. And Germany, some of the funniest things that happened is that we had a situation where we were having failures. Saba was our partner in Germany. And I went over to address the problem, and it was more like a political visit.
Yeah, right.
And I went there, and I was in a meeting, and one of the things I didn't realize, in Germany, the criteria for addressing vendors is different.
Right.
They're not cordial if they don't want to be. And I
Wait a minute, that's different how from America?
Well, for instance, one gentleman who had a turtleneck sweater on and smoked his cigarettes with his hand closed out like this.
Wish you could see that, folks.
Yes, and saying, bitch, none of you is
get the camera. I want a picture.
Yeah,
so you got to do that again.
Yeah.
I got to be able to post this. Sometimes radio doesn't do justice.
Oh, radio, yeah.
No.
Bitch, none of you is the chief engineer.
Thank
and
you.
I went, me.
Are you incompetent? How could you have allowed this to happen?
And I'm sitting there going, well, trying to be a diplomat, I find myself trying to flowery express that I think he's in error. But what happened was my friend, who was the sales guy, the local German guy, looks at me, Kurt says, Jetty, most Germans understand English, but they don't understand the eloquence of your language when you are trying to be subtle. So I'm going to repeat again what you said in German, so the true meaning comes out.
I can't wait for this one.
Well, instead of it saying, I think you're in error, it comes out, you dummkopf.
Oh no, what's that mean?
Stupid dummy. And I'm sitting there in my broken German, I'm going, Kurt! And Kurt Lauser, this guy goes in flame, goes ballistic.
Oh, I bet.
So the next thing he does, he starts screaming at me in German. And I'm sitting there, and all of a sudden, the people representing his company that are at the table also.
Right.
One says, Hamzi, we must conduct this meeting in English for Herr Lawson to understand. And I said, you don't have to. He just called him and said, you know, I told him I repeat back what they said in English. He says, the German's quite good. So they go back to German again. So the guy comes up, stands up, and he says to me, you will not return to my plant after lunch. I will not allow you in there. I will throw you out. You gonna throw me out? And I gotta laugh, right? So I go to lunch, and the people are saying, what do you intend to do? I'm coming back. And I'm gonna come back to this production floor. We'll see.
We'll see what happens.
So I came back, walked in, and in Germany, his office was right smack dab in the middle of the production floor, glass on all four sides. And I walked in, folded my arms, and sat there and just looked at his office, waiting for him to come out. And it was almost like the takeoff in a movie, like High Noon. You know? I mean, I was sitting there waiting, right? And, you know, for a showdown, all right? He wouldn't come out of that office. And I finally said, the heck with this. I turned to his people and said, this is how we're going to resolve this. And we started resolving it. That night, I went back to Munich. And in my room, I was knocked on the door. It's the president of the company.
Wow.
And he said, hey, Lawson, you have a minute? I said, sure. He came and he said, I want to thank you for not backing down. I said, I wasn't about to back down. In fact, you might have lost your production manager. I was willing to snap his neck. And he said, well, you must understand how we do things here in Germany. It's what? He said, we cannot get rid of a person for being nasty and evil, only for being incompetent. I said, okay. But I said, there's a way to be cordial to get a job done.
Yeah.
Right? He said, yeah. So he agreed, and I did my thing for a couple more days and hired some extra people to help out and walked out. But it's running to things like that. You know, around the world, there's different feelings of how things you work with people and that kind of
thing. Right.
And I was willing to work with him, but I said I wasn't going to be browbeaten by him. The other thing, since it was my second visit to Germany, I wanted to go to see one of the concentration camps. And Kurt said to me in a very stern voice, he said, Jerry, I am not going to take you there. We Germans do not like that. I said, all right, well, I can understand that. But I still wouldn't, you know, want to go. So you go by yourself. Said, okay, fine, you know. And the next day, Kurt bends over to me and very straightforward said, Jerry, I said, yeah? Have you heard about the new German microwave oven?
Oh, no.
I said, no. It says Seats 12.
Ah! Damn!
After calling him a few choice names.
Oh, man. Ah, the good old days.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So you got out of the garage. Fairchild's asking you to make something for them.
Mm-hmm.
How do you get started with that? I mean, you're looking around at what's out there. Give me the foundation of the Fairchild Channel F. How did you come up with the stuff?
Well, we had a feasibility model with Alpex that we started with. But to put it in production was a big change. And some of the things that were we added to it is that we had some outstanding mechanical functions in the way of two guys. One name was Ron Smith and the other one was named Nick Talisker. The other parts of it was I had a great crew of guys that I picked up at Fairchild by going around, and it was like the Pied Piper. It was like I went around and picked guys up that were in the company already and told them, hey, fellas, we got a chance to do something, and wouldn't explain it what it was. And it was like, it was the Pied Piper. They all joined. Okay.
And what year are we talking about? Let's give the listeners sort of an idea.
Okay,
what are we
talking
about?
That was like in 75.
So what was around video game style at that point in time? I mean, what were you...
Atari had made Pong.
Right.
As a portable, as a land game, home game. That was about all it was going. And as the microprocessor was still coming out, 6502, there was this wonderful company that was Steve Wozniak. And he even interviewed me for the job because he was working for HP at the time.
Oh.
Yeah. In fact, the whole division was moving to Corvallis, and he didn't want to go. Then, funny enough, was another guy that showed up. I got to tell you this story. This is funny.
Oh, yeah. Tell me the funny story.
Oh, gosh.
Just before I started working on the Fairchild thing, I'll never forget this. 4 o'clock one Saturday morning, I get a call. I pick up the phone. Yeah? Who is this? I need technical support.
What?
What?
You called your house at 4 a.m?
You need what? I need technical support. Well, gee, I don't call my doctor 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
He insisted. He needed to. I said, this guy must be kidding, right? I hung up. Half hour later, rings again. I'm going to call Wolf Corrigan. Oh, you are? You're supposed to come help me with this F8 problem. I said, I don't believe this idiot. He calls again. I tell my wife, this is it. About 6 o'clock, I got dressed. Went to this guy's location. I get out of the car. The guy is walking around in front of his building doing figure eights. I get out of the car and he looks and he says, you're Jerry Lawson? I said, yeah, mother, I'm Jerry Lawson. So I walk in his plant. He has this one guy working on this breadboard system. And they had this, so I said, what's the problem? He said, well, I can't make your F8 move the square from here to there. And I look at his instructions on the, I said, well, because you ain't asking it to move from there to there. All right? So I quickly get on the keyboard and write another program. Well, patch it in. And say, okay, now take that aisle bit, right, touch it to the ground. And this is the ground, square moved across the screen. Okay? Yeah. Now listen, right. Don't call me again. Right? And he said, don't call me. I mean this. You disturb my wife, you disturb me. I don't call my doctor at 4 o'clock tomorrow. Okay? So the guy that was working on it felt embarrassed too.
Well, yeah.
Well, a few months later, I'm doing it for Fairchild. Okay? The word gets around, I'm hiring. Same guy shows up.
Oh.
The guy, not the boss.
Right.
The guy. And he looked at me very sheepishly when he saw me. And I said, oh, hi, Mike, how are you? He said, fine. He said, what are you here for? Oh, I hear you guys are hiring programming. I said, yeah, we are.
Oh, what are you doing here?
He said, the interview is with me. And he went, oh. Come on, Mike.
Right.
I sat down, I talked to him. He said, I'll be willing to try it. Come on. He said, you hiring me? Yeah, I'm hiring you. Well, I'm about that incident to happen. I said, I ain't got nothing to do with your capability. All right? I'm looking for people to do the job, not personal problems I've ever had with them. Okay? You don't have to like me. Just work.
Yeah. Do your job. I don't care what you say.
Right? And he said, oh, okay. And he was a brilliant programmer. He did an excellent job. He's a guy that also, we found out, he put the first Easter egg in a game.
Really?
Yeah. It was the Easter egg in Spitfire, where he had it, where if you went to a sequence of numbers that you put into the machine, it'd come up and say programmed by Mike Glass.
Wow.
Yeah, so he But he was a great guy. He was a gamester. He learned programming, and he knew what a game was. It was something I told in another interview. I said the trick in any a lot of kids come to me and they want to program games.
Right.
But I said it's not learning the program. Programming is the second part of it.
Yes. Okay?
It's learning what is a good game. Today's technology, not one guy does a game.
Right.
It's a team of people. There's a guy that comes up with the game flow, what it does. The guys that do the graphics and animation. Then there's guys that do the programming of the individual games. Okay. Different.
Yeah. But,
and one of the tricks in the game is that there's an attract mode you've got to have. When a game isn't doing something, not being played, it should be doing something to show you it's working, doing something. To allow you to go, oh, what's that? You know, if it just sits there static and doesn't do anything, it doesn't turn anybody on.
Right.
The other thing about a game is that it should have variable skill level. When you walk in it, it's important that you walk into a game, you're not an instant expert. Let it grab you a little bit to where you want to feel like you want to conquer something. And let it increase in complexity as you increase your ability and skills. That's a good game. Okay? And let the game be so varied that you don't overnight overcome the game.
Right.
Okay? But if you make the game way too difficult, a lot of people are turned off. You make it way too easy, a lot of people turn off. So you have to have that good balance, okay? I have seen people play the attract mode on a game, and they thought they were playing the game, and they weren't. I mean, we had a guy one time, like one of the things our marketing people said, you know, the hand controllers are too difficult to operate. Oh, okay, well, what do you want? Can you have some kind of demo thing? I said, Mike, can you do a demo so that people learn how to operate the hand controller? He said, oh, okay. So what he did was he had a way that was a text output. And he would have a way that when you grab the hand controller, it would say, the first thing it would say is, do not push the reset button. Well, that would start the game.
Right.
Okay. But he would have in there, turn right. Now, if you turn left, it would say, that's not right, that's left. Okay.
Your other left.
Yeah, the other one. It said, pull it up. No, that's down, right? And it was that way, it was interactive.
Right.
Well, I watched in a CES show one time, there was a guy sitting there, and for 15 minutes, he kept pushing the reset button.
What?
And it would say, please do not push the reset button. Okay. Please do not push the reset button. Okay. Please do not push the reset button. I'm watching this guy going, I don't believe this. He keeps pushing the reset button. I said, oh my God, look at this, right? So I go up to the sir, yeah? It's broke. No, it ain't broke. You broke.
You're broke.
I said, it's saying, please do not push the reset button. You keep pushing the reset button. Oh! I went, see, for some people you can't win.
No. You expect people to read, you already lost them.
I've said one of the things that is really bad about any consumer product is that I have built military equipment.
Yeah.
And they said the worst spec is to build something military. I said, wrong. The worst spec is to build something for consumer. I can control the military by training them.
Right.
I can tell a guy, if you beat on this console, I'm going to put you in the guardhouse. Okay?
Right.
You use this, I'm going to put you away. All right?
Yeah.
And if you can't use it, I'm going to train you. And I'm going to give you a test, and if you're not capable, you ain't touching it. You can't do that with a consumer.
No.
When you bring out a consumer device, everybody's an instant expert.
None of that's changed either.
Yeah, and then they grab something, and they go, oh, I know how this is done. They don't know what they're doing. And if you expect them to read, they get it.
Yeah, you can't expect them to read. It's got to be pictures or movies.
Even that, they don't work right. Now, the old story I was telling a guy one time is that I described the Hell Day. Now, in the consumer business, the first year we put out the video game, the day after Christmas is called Hell Day.
All the returns, the phone calls.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And what happens is that you don't get to find out because people buy things as gifts and they don't bother to look at it. wakes up right on Christmas Day. And what do? They don't read anything.
Nope.
They open it quick, throw the box open, grab all the pieces and say, okay, here we go. He would go where? I had one guy took the whole game apart looking for the batteries. Had it all unscrewed, screws apart this way. Called me and said, I can't find where the batteries go. It doesn't have batteries. So. Oh, it can't work without batteries. Yes, it does. That's why it has that black thing that plugs into the wall. Right? He said, oh! Oh! Another woman said, will dog urine hurt the game?
What? Huh? No, she didn't.
Yes, she did.
Dog urine hurt the game.
She said, her dog spotted this new thing in the entry of the house, lifted his leg, and christened it.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I had another one. Now, I'm catching all these calls, and I'm not supposed to be there. I'm the chief engineer, not marketing.
Yeah, that's right.
Not customer service.
That's not.
Oh, those people took a vacation.
Nice. They're on Christmas break.
Yeah, all right.
They
great.
Left you in there. They call you at 4
Me
o'clock in the
guard.
Morning.
And the guard. And the guard is getting calls, and he's trying to feel them. Well, after the 25th call, you get a little frazzled.
Yeah.
So your answers don't come as nice as they used to. Okay?
Start talking in German.
No, worse than that. I had a woman call me. My game hums! Do you know why? And I go, because I don't know the words, lady.
Man, I gotta write that with that.
Oh, I mean, and you go, oh, I don't know.
She's gonna call back in 5 minutes, damn it. It's not like you can hang up on her hoping somebody else in the next cube gets
Well, no, then nobody in the next cube was me.
Yeah.
And so then you start talking in Chinese English. No, got wrong number. Who called somebody else? It's not me. Huh?
You want the chicken or the rice?
Mm-hmm.
Awesome.
Yeah.
All right, now you got. We're gonna have to talk about the controllers at some point in time.
Oh, yeah, okay.
What was the speaker wire?
The speaker wire?
I swear, every time I think about the Fairchild, the first thing I think of is that thin, breakable, hard to replace speaker wire that controls. What was up with that?
That wire. Again, I didn't specify.
Oh, you didn't do that?
No, should have.
You should have.
Well, I let the mechanical people specify it, right?
Big Were they serial wire. Installers or what? Because that was speaker wire.
It was. They got it from overseas. And when they first got it, we thought tensile strength was all right. It wasn't.
No.
And what happened is that the way they make those cables is that they thread the wire and then put the covering on them. Okay? So it isn't like it's somebody else's long surge multi-conductor cable. They make it a multi-conductor cable. And what was wrong with it is that in order to meet the flexibility inside,
right,
they use the lower gauge wire to keep from hampering the hand control.
Right.
As a result, it paid the price. What it really should have been, but it would have cost a lot more money,
yeah,
was flex wiring or litz wire. You ever know what a litz wire is?
Maybe I do, but I don't know the name.
Wire is wire that they've used for years on telephone headsets and used for headphones.
Okay.
And what litz wire is, it's a wire that is made in a curlicle, helical wiring. And they're very flexible. You can take litz wire and beat it to place in Sunny, it won't break. Okay.
Like the ColecoVision used something like that, didn't they?
Some of them did, yes. The other problem we had was that because we used them in the I/O port and there were no real signals on those wires, there's a thing in electronics and mechanics that's called self-wiping, or cleaning actually. Is that when you hit the contacts, there's enough of current being drawn that it actually cleans the contact. We didn't clean the contacts. So as a result, any dust that got inside was a problem.
Right.
We only looked at it later to say, oh, well, maybe we need to put a rubber boot around the top of it to try to keep contaminants from going inside. And, you know, again, that the consumer is not going to be mindful that he ain't going to stick it in the dirt or, you know,
dog peed on it.
Yeah. Or, you know, beat his wife in the head with it. You know, you don't know. See, like I said, if it was military, I could control it. If it's consumer, no way.
No.
Okay?
Idiot proof.
It's not idiot.
Not idiot proof. No.
I don't care what you do.
Yeah. Someone's going to mess it up.
Someone will mess it up.
That's right.
In fact, we worked very hard on making it more durable. Because one of the things we found was that the plastic guys were using what is known as regrind. And regrind is when they make the part and it's not right, they stick it back into a hopper and grind it up again and use it again.
Right. That makes
when
sense.
You do that, it weakens the plastic. And one of the things you needed to put into the plastic too was fiberglass strands that would strengthen it. And that would raise the price of it too.
Yeah.
So one of the things was that we had done this no regrind, all that jazz, and we had customers sitting there saying, well, your hand controllers break, you know, blah, 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 blah. So here I am, chief engineer, trying to defend the position that we had done enough work now that it wouldn't work.
Yeah, yeah.
And I grabbed the hand controller and I said, look, I do like this with my strength, right? And as soon as I turned it, I felt it give. And I went, oh, God, right, you know. So what I did was I applied more pressure, wham, I pulled it apart. And then the guy goes, well, it broke. I said, yeah, but see these lines?
Look at these guns.
All right, can you do that? Oh, yeah, I can see that, yeah. Well,
yeah, you're right, yeah. I guess so. What was the thought? Now, I know you didn't really have anything to go off of, right? What was the thought of not making the controllers replaceable? Did you just figure no one would ever need to replace a controller?
No. The reason why they weren't controllable first or replaceable is because there was not an economic connection system.
Oh.
At the time.
Makes sense.
You see, and it wasn't until Atari and a few other game companies started moving in that direction that the DB9 connector, which is known as,
yeah,
made in plastic, became cheap enough.
Gotcha.
Before, it was a computer interface part.
Yeah.
And very expensive. So we couldn't use it. It wasn't until more game companies started commanding and demanding it, and Atari came on board, that we could even go back and say, okay, let's now change it. That's what we did when we made Model 2 of it.
Right.
We changed it to where now the connector was a DB9, right? We would sell replacement hand controllers. You could screw them up, you get another set, you know.
Right.
But it was almost impossible on the original model for the average guy to change it. Because even if he could open the box, the connecting system was, we had feed throughs with a special connector inside. And he had to know which way to plug it in and feed it back and put the...
Yeah, they can't even figure out dog urine. They ain't going to be able to figure out which way to plug it in.
No.
No.
No. So that was a big problem.
Yeah.
And we thought System 2 would alleviate most of those problems. But again, when you're the first guy on the block,
you got
learn. You learn. Okay?
Now, who did you develop the controllers? Because those controllers are amazing and disgusting at the same time, if you don't mind my saying so.
I don't mind. I only developed the concept of it.
Okay.
Ron Smith actually did the physical connection, made them.
Because the controller was... At one point, it felt good.
Mm-hmm.
But then at the other point, it was almost like there was too much going on. It was a spring in there, right?
Yes. There were leaves. There were leaves and a spring.
Right. Because you could push down, you could pull up,
there were two
and you
sets
could turn.
There were two sets of leaf contacts that went this way.
Right.
That plane, two that went this way. Okay? There was one down at the bottom that turned, too. There was a spring coil that went on the bottom. Okay? To bounce up and down on.
Right. Right.
It was a lot going in that hand controller.
There was tons going in there. There's never been a controller like it since. Not even close. But at the same time, it's like when you're thinking about the controller, you're thinking, I need to be able to compensate for any possibility that the player might need. I mean, you've got buttons you can push in, like controls you can push in, mm-hmm. like on the DualShock controller on the PlayStation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But that didn't come around for a long time. You know, and there's still no spinning ones.
Well, and the other thing that hand controller did, a lot of people didn't appreciate it.
That concludes part one of our interview with Jerry Lawson. Tune in next month when we conclude our interview with Jerry Lawson from the Classic Gaming Expo 2005. Well, folks, we have such a giant bits and bytes, we better get right to it. Never-ending bits and bytes, I think. Well over 100 sites to look at. Truly amazing. Now, this is pretty funny. Somebody sent me something called the Ghetto LAN Party. And apparently, this is something happens down in Texas. And they have this big geek party where apparently they play pretty much everything. What I think is really funny, though, is there's just nothing here that I could even remotely see as interesting to my listeners, which always cracks me up when people send in things that are so incredibly wrong. I mean, let's scroll down here. First of all, it's got a picture of Eric Estrada on the front. Now, I don't know about you, but that means run where I come from. Scroll down the page, Quake 4, scroll down the page, five-man Counter-Strike tournament, etc., etc. And the only reason I even bother to talk about this is because it's so wildly inappropriate. But anyway, I'll post a link for that. Way more funny than it should be. Hey, remember the old game Boulder Dash? Big 8-bit classic. Everybody played it. Spawned a bajillion sequels and knockoffs. Well, the original folks, First Star Software, apparently are still around. They have a website. And it looks like they're going to be doing something with the property in the future. So you can actually go in here and get some historical looks at it, at the whole, you know, Boulder Dash thing, Spy versus Spy, tons of other stuff that they did. At First Star made some great stuff, folks, and it's very interesting to go back here and look at some of this stuff. Spy versus Spy was one of my favorite 8-bit titles ever. So kind of a crappy website, but hey, you're not going here to look at the cool HTML leetness. You're going here to get some history about some of these cool titles. Okay, what else do we got? Oh, yes, apparently somebody's working on a version of Impossible Mission for the Game Boy Advance. Now, it's apparently a remake. Don't have a lot of information on it. I have a page, and I have a link where you can download a demo. I have not yet tried the demo, but I figured I would pass that along to you guys, and you can take a look at it. If the guy screams and you throw him in a hole, that's the best part of the game. So as long as I got that working. So Japan government instituted a ban on Grand Theft Auto 3. Under 18 ban on Capcom distributed Grand Theft Auto 3 now in effect. So we have a nice little write up here from GameSpot. I've seen the game myself, says the governor, and it's far too violent and obviously harmful. If you think a video game is harmful, you have no business being the governor. But this is all kind of old news, but every now and then we get a different little slice of the news. I wanted to pass that along. Interesting stuff. Hey, remember a while back we talked about Acclaim going under, about a year ago. Now news from The Inquirer. How reliable is that, right? Acclaim execs accused of financial malpractice. Okay, yeah, well, a year after it folded, the trustee appointed to settle bust video game publisher Acclaim's affairs has accused the company's former executives of operating Acclaim in many instances as if it were a personal piggy bank. Wow. Have we, like, never heard this before or what? Just proving that video game companies are just as corrupt and gruesome as other publicly held companies. In the Microsoft attempt to look like the good guys approach, they apparently praised the revolution. It's not uncommon to hear competitors compliment one another, sometimes backhandedly. How about always backhandedly? Yet it is still interesting to hear. Another spelling error on OneUp.com. What's that all about? GamingIndustry.biz caught up with corporate VP of Worldwide Marketing and Publishing for Xbox, Peter Moore, to talk about Nintendo's unveiled Revolution controller. The guy says, I want to give kudos for Nintendo, shouldn't it be kudos to Nintendo, whatever, for its attempt at innovation with the new controller, saying that the revolution would bring people in that are either lapsed gamers or gamers that are intimidated by the complexity of the controller. Now, how about just fun games to play? How'd that be? Yeah, whatever. There'll be a couple more things like that. Satoru Iwata. You know I can't tell you these Japanese names at all. Anyway, we got a video interview of the number one guy at Nintendo. Good stuff there, of course. talks about innovation with the DS, the revolution, et cetera, et cetera. As you guys can see, I'm getting pretty excitable about Nintendo these days. Only people I think that can save the industry, but what do I know? Here's another article about hands-on with the Revolution controller from IGN.com. They talk about the features, some of the games that they played, the demos that they played, et cetera, et cetera. We've kind of already talked a little bit about the Revolution already for this episode, but again, I'll point them out because I happen to believe this stuff. I do believe that the Revolution will be the next evolution of non-gaming games, and I think that a lot of people get their paws on games that never would before the Revolution. Let the journey begin. Evolution of Nintendo. This got sent in. It's a nice little historical look at Nintendo, what they've done, you know, the whole bit from TV Game 6 all the way through modern days. Good stuff. Again, I don't want to sit and talk about Nintendo Revolution the whole time, but suffice to say, we have another link for you. Hey, remember back in the old days, for some of you who are old enough to remember, if you could say what's the one thing you remember about floppy disks, other than the fact that they went bad all the time, they were flexible and black, but is there anything else that you immediately springs to mind when you think about floppy disks? Well, for a lot of us, it was a black elephant. Yeah, where does that come from, right? Remember on the old floppy disks, one of the most popular brand was Elephant Memory Systems, although at the time I didn't know really what EMS stood for, that it was even called EMS. But a lot of the floppy disks that I had in my possession bore the semblance of this black elephant from EMS. Well, there's a fan site up that you can actually get artwork from this, along with the sleeves and the labels and everything else that came in these EMS boxes. Good stuff. Worth looking at. When I saw this logo, I was like, wow, that's pretty cool. I totally remember that. So not the best site in the world, but, you know, what do you want? It's a fan site. CNET's top 10 games of the past 10 years. Yeah, well, we know about these top 10 lists. And somebody asked me today, actually, a non-gamer. We were talking about my show. And he said, well, you know, what's your top 10 games of all time? And I said, if you have to ask that, you're not a gamer. Not a true gamer. Not passionate about the history of gaming. Because if you really think about it, what's the number 10? Of the hundreds of systems over the last 25 years with literally tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of video games, how could you possibly bring them down to 10, even the period of a decade? Well, what made the list at CNET.com, and what do I think about it? Half-Life was the number one game on the list. Half-Life was definitely a good game. There's no two ways about it. StarCraft, never got the draw to StarCraft. Warcraft was okay. Yeah. To me, Command & Conquer redefined what RTS should be. The Sims was number three. Number four is Quake. Yeah. Quake's just another first-person shooter as far as I'm concerned. I don't care the fact that it was real 3D. Nobody knew the difference before. John Madden Football. I guess, I don't know. EverQuest, Halo, Metal Gear Solid, Grand Theft Auto 3. That one I might agree with. Legend of Zelda, Legend of Zelda, Ocarina of Time. Ocarina. What does that mean in Japanese? Somebody write in and tell me. I know it's got to mean something. Anyway, so that's their top 10 list. Can't say that I totally agree with it. Grand Theft Auto, maybe Half-Life. Hard to say. I'd have to go back and look at it. But again, to even attempt to put 10 games over a 10-year time span, totally pointless. Filler. Someone of our GameCube fanatics, which I can totally understand now that I've got a cube and been playing Resident Evil 4, there's a technical overview for all you geek people about what's actually inside the cube. It's hard to make fun of the cube when you actually can look at this stuff and read what's inside this box. What can I tell you? It's worth looking at, especially if you're a total geek, like half of us or more really are. Here's a link. The DS Linux site is attempting to get a full implementation of some sort of Linux running on the Nintendo DS. They actually look like they have a Zork game running on here under Linux. Hey, you know, whatever floats your boat. Me, personally, can't see a lot of practical application unless you want to play text adventures on it. But hey, you know what? The more you guys want to work with the DS, the better. The Escapist writes, escapistmagazine.com writes, death to the games industry. And yeah, this talks a lot about the stuff that I've already talked about many, many times. But it's another article to sort of back up what I've always said. Let's see here. Let me see if I can find a nice little passage that that really sounds good. Well, they're talking about the budget, the typical game budget from... This is a good example. Typical game budget from 1995 to 2003. Here's the quote. As recently as 1992, the typical development budget for a PC game was as little as $200,000. Today, if you want a title that will be taken seriously by the retailers, an A-level title, your minimum buy-in is $5 million. Yeah, something to think about, man. When you squeeze so many people out of the market, what do you expect? And here's something else that I've said over and over again, too. The problem is that once something becomes technically feasible, the market demands it. And some of the other paragraph headings glitz over gameplay. Let's see what else we got here. The narrow-mindedness of the retail channel. It's a pretty good article. In the game industry, you get one shot. You have 2 weeks. If you haven't achieved sales velocity, you are dead. Talk to Shenmue and Sega. They can tell you all about it. Anyway, good article. If you guys want to take a look at that. What do we got here? Oh, here's an article. This is pretty old, but, you know, somebody sent it in, and it's kind of funny. Why Sony PSP will suck. So here we go. These were the same people that had the We Love Sony PSP thing, and then a bunch of people yelled and bitched at them, so they had to write why it will suck. How's that for being a flip-flop, right? Let's see. Some of the high-level notes here. $250 is a slap in all of our faces, not because it's not worth the cash, because of all the useless accessories Sony decided to bundle with the system. We've talked about that. 1 gigabyte cards are expensive. You'll need at least 1 gig if you plan on enjoying a decent amount of MP3s or if you plan on watching any movies. Some of the movies I've encoded MP4 are larger than 650 megabytes, so 512 is not an option. Games range from $40 to $50. There's no killer app. Movie conversion to MP4 is a pain. Headphone and remote cord is a travesty. Music organization doesn't exist. We'll need to wait for a better battery. System will not boot straight to the interface if you've got a game installed. PSP will suck every drop of oil in your fingers and apply them directly to the screen. No second analog stick. Pouch that comes with the system is a joke. Downloading firmware an unnecessary hassle. You guys can read the points in between. So, there you have that. Yeah, you knew this Rockstar thing wasn't over, were it, didn't you? ESRB, the Entertainment Software Rating Board, sent out an email to all of the video game publishers, the major publishers, basically saying that any content on the disc now has to be disclosed, even if it's never intended to be accessed during gameplay. You know what? This is just so gay. This is so gay. If you have to hack something to get to it, if you have to alter the box, if you have to do anything like that to get to this hidden content, you know what? You are asking for it. You're making an appointment to get it. It's not like you accidentally sit down on a toilet seat and, oops, I've got AIDS. Right? That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about going to a whorehouse saying, excuse me, could I have the whore with AIDS, please? Oh, no, keep the condoms. I'm good to go. And then going, how come I got AIDS? That's what we're talking about here. This is not a matter of somebody being irresponsible. You know what? I can't go on with this. This thing just bugs the crap out of me. If you want to hear more about me bitching, talk about it, or look at it last month's show. Last month's show, I talk a lot about that. Not really gaming related, but something that's always been near and dear to my heart, the Opera web browser is actually now 100% free. No ads, no licensing. That's right, free. No nothing. No, you can't even license it. It's free. Absolutely free. No hitches, no glitches, nothing. How did Opera manage to do this? They're making enough money on embedded software, putting Opera into cell phones and embedded devices that they can now afford to subsidize, just like Microsoft does, and allow you to have the browser for free. So you no longer have any excuse to be using Firefox. Opera is the bomb. Plain and simple. Crytek. Yes. I've been told that the new Far Cry game has the best engine of all time, and I would just basically be a bonehead not to talk about how leet and cool this new engine is and how it's just going to revolutionize everything. Well, I watched the video clip, which was shot with a camcorder in some demo. Okay, the engine looks great. Too bad I don't know anything about the game. Yeah, dynamic day and night cycles, interactive environments, trees blowing in the wind, soft shadows. You know what? Means zero to me. I play games for games. I don't play games to count how many polys the frickin' leaf has that's blowing in the wind. So, I will give you a link to the video. You can make your own choices on that. It's getting harder and harder these days for us to own a computer and own anything on it. As we all know, Windows Vista. What a great name that is, Vista. Frankly, they should have stuck with Longhorn, because what Longhorn will produce for you is exactly what real Longhorns do. It produces crap. Crap that comes out of the bull. That's your Longhorn for you. Why do you think it was called Longhorn? Did you ever wonder that? Longhorn, dude. It's a bull. What comes out of the back of a bull? I'm just saying. Anyway, Windows Vista is going to have no less than 7 separate editions. Starter Edition, Home Basic Edition, Home Premium Edition, Pro Edition, Small Business Edition, Enterprise Edition, Ultimate Edition. And somewhere along the way, if you search Google and search for Dvorak's article on Windows Vista, he offers you other versions like the porn version and some other great things. I don't have the link here. I wish I had remembered to bring that up. But corporate XP is now gone, by the way, with Vista. There will no longer any version of Windows that does not need to be activated. So, get ready to have Microsoft browsing around your systems, folks, because Windows activation is no longer an option. I won't talk too much more. You guys know my feelings on Windows Vista. But anyway, take a look at the article and see where the insanity. It's not bad enough we have to have like 2 or 3 Xbox 360s. Now we got to have 7 versions of Windows. More people trying to stop people from getting stuff. Michigan's Granholm signs mature gaming bill. In the latest of a string of state-specific legislation related to video games, Michigan Governor Jennifer M. Granholm, hey, she's not too bad looking from this picture, announces she will sign legislation later this week that will make the sale or rental of mature or adult-rated video games to children illegal. Did I just miss something here? I thought that you... But never mind. Anyway, the fine for anyone caught selling a violent title, apparently defined by the bill as real or simulated graphic depictions of physical injury or physical violence against parties who realistically appear to be human beings. So you're not going to be able... You shouldn't be able to buy football games anymore, folks. Real or simulated graphic depictions. Well, tackling somebody's physical injury and physical violence, folks. So I better start seeing in Michigan. I want some of my Michigan listeners to write in and tell me that Madden 07 or Madden 06 is considered a violent title. Please, let me know. Because otherwise I'm going to call this biatch a hypocrite. Nothing like using interpretation to manage the sheep. Anyway, up to $40,000 in jail time. Up to 90 days, hefty fines, etc., etc. So, there you go. Once again, people taking it to the extreme. Someone sent in a couple of Japanese freeware games, a couple of platformers. I'm just going to post the links. One of them's called Ikachan, whatever. You know I can't do the Japanese things. Anyway, it looks cute. Didn't have time to try it. Play a squid. You know, that alone should make it worth looking at the page. And then there's another one, too. I'm not sure where it's buried in this whole list of links that I'm looking at, but suffice to say, check it out. Oh, yes. Somebody decided, first of all, to build a 3-foot working Game Boy video game handheld, and then made a page with dark red and dark blue letters on it. So, the Game Man is a fully functional 6.5 times scale Game Boy complete with working cartridges. It's over 3 feet tall and weighs just over 100 pounds of the cartridge. Now, maybe take some time away from porting cartridges to your 3-foot Game Boy and learn how to put non-blue text on dark red backgrounds. I don't know. My eyes are bleeding. But anyway, it's amazing what people have free time to do. Microsoft to buy stake in AOL. Now, there's just something that just makes you want to run for the hills, doesn't it? Along with Windows Vista, Microsoft wants to buy into AOL. The world is coming to an end as we know it. Run, run, run. According to various sources, Microsoft is in talk with Time Warner to buy a stake in AOL. While the size of the stake or its prize have not been disclosed, Bloomberg speculates that this deal would profit both companies. Well, yeah. Microsoft would profit from merging the AOL portal with MSN. Psh, nice. That's just what we need. MSN, MSAOL, right? What the hell, man? When you want to go blind and deaf. That should take care of the rest of your life. As a strategy to catch up with its rivals in this space, Yahoo and Google. You ain't going to rival Google with its elite JavaScript coders and everything else with frickin' AOL. Yeah, that's like trying to convince someone who's eating a steak that this can of Spam looks really tasty. I'm going to merge my can of Spam with my foot in your ass. And then maybe you'll be lured away from Google. What's that all about? Anyway, interesting Slashdot article. Lots of posts on that. Retro Gamer T-shirt from Jinx.com. Sometimes I think the people who run this site write me about this stuff. Very simple T-shirts are selling. Black with Retro Gamer with a sword in between. With a GamesAreFun.com ad on the back. Yeah. So anyway, check it out. See what you think. Would I wear one? Probably not. But hey, you know, send me a free one. I'll wear it. Excuse me, 2XL, please. Go ahead and send that over. You got my address on the site. Hardcore Gamer Magazine. Now, I'm told that this online e-zine does not have a lot of old game stuff in it. I haven't actually had a chance to look closely at it. But apparently the magazine's pretty good stuff, written in by one of our regulars. So chances are it doesn't totally suck. They've got 4 issues out. In fact, I'll pop one open real quick and we'll see what kind of quality classic gaming is in here. They bill new games, old games, console games, arcade games, portable games, and game stuff. So let's see exactly what old games and game stuff means. Of course, it might take a while. What's this all about? Not 10 minutes. Forget that. Get a faster server and call me next month. Controller history. This is kind of interesting. A history of gaming input devices from stolen switches to analog triggers. This will be one of those things that those of you at home who want to know the origins of the PlayStation 1 controller, that sort of thing. It's actually kind of interesting. They have some good old stuff on here. I'm not gonna make fun of it, even though it is on 1UP. But take a look at it. See what you guys think. I like some of this, like the old computer space controllers. That's fun stuff. Fun stuff. Hey, Rupert Murdoch, our very favorite guy that owns Fox News, the fair and balanced news. Yeah, I'm not even going to get into that. Anyway, he have just acquired the rights to video game portal IGN, which is too bad because I actually use IGN to look at DS stuff. Now I've got to find someplace else to go. Yeah, Rupert Murdoch News Corp made its latest acquisition in the internet sector Thursday, agreeing to pay $650 million in cash for IGN. Man, $650 million. That's just insane. For those of you who think that I'm being unnecessarily biased towards Nintendo this month, here is Nintendo's era of censorship. In today's era of Xbox and PlayStation, it's often easy to forget that at one time, the North American video game market was almost singularly dominated by one firm, Nintendo of America. For many years, Nintendo enjoyed a privileged position in the game industry that at times seemed to be borderline monopoly. Yeah, that's true. Anyway, you can continue to read about Nintendo's monopolistic practices and censorship right on this site here. I think you'll get a good... it's a good read, if nothing else. It's got to make a lot of good points. So, yeah, I was... Why do you think I went with a Genesis instead of a Super Nintendo, man? Mortal Kombat, no blood. Hey, you don't take blood out of Mortal Kombat. World's most expensive NES cartridge. The Nintendo World Championships 1990 went for $6,100. $6,100. So what exactly is this? It's a cartridge, has some dip switches on it. Very clean, still works perfectly, blah, blah, blah. I don't know what the actual game is, to be honest with you. But it looks rare. Yep. Yeah, Surrey Bob. $6,100. I could have bought like two cars with that. Yeah, interesting. The new Myst game, subtitled End of Ages. Is that a scary foreshadowing or what? Cyan World slashes staff, suspends development. Myst developers' decision to close game production unit sends employees packing, with Myst 5 End of Ages release unaffected. If you're going to name something End of Ages, doesn't that just... I'm sorry, that creeps me out. Anyway, basically, everybody got sent home. Someday, maybe we'll let you guys all come back, etc., etc. I don't know, man. A lot of people love Myst. It was like one of the biggest games ever that people always talk about. 1993 was the release of Myst, first release for the Macintosh, later ported to the PC, as well as the Saturn, PlayStation, Jaguar, 3DO consoles, and not mentioned the Amiga got a port. Okay, thanks, bye. Together with its sequel, Riven, the game sold more than 12 million copies. Now, how do you sell 12 million copies of a game and then go under writing basically the same game? I don't know. You'd think that that would work out. It seems to work for everybody else. Here's an article talking about the Super Nintendo, as good as it's going to get. Basically, these guys say that Super Nintendo was as good as it ever gets, and why? Let's see. Here we go. The other major strength of the Super Nintendo is one that gives it the lasting power that it has are the games. The one that gives it the lasting power that it has are the games. Interesting. No system before or since has had a set of games on par with the titles offered on this console. Part of being the successor of NES meant that consumers would be expecting new versions of their favorite titles. So basically, Super Nintendo invented game whoring. Good thing to have in that article. Anyway, you can check it out if you want. Hey, not everybody seems to be happy about the new consoles. What's that all about? Isn't it great to have a billion times more power at your disposal to write the same video games over and over again? Well, let's go inside and talk to Valve. Valve boss hits out at Vista and the next-gen consoles. They only make developers' lives harder. Head honcho Gabe Newell of Valve has been speaking at length on the next generation of video game platforms, consoles, and Vista, and he hasn't been sounding hugely enthusiastic about what's to come from a developer's point of view. Speaking to 1UP.com, how do they get this stuff? As part of a week of Valve coverage, Newell said, "I cannot point to a single feature in Longhorn that I care about. There's nothing in Longhorn that solves any problems for us at all." Yeah, well, but you'll be able to have 3D icons. Come on, how does that not solve a problem? He also said the same about the upcoming game consoling platform, stating that the Xbox 360 doesn't make my life any better and, in fact, makes it a lot worse. "You're telling me I cannot rely on having a hard drive." Damn it, people. Didn't I just talk about this? People got to start listening to me. They've taken the Xbox and turned it into a PC, which inevitably means that you cannot count on two Xboxes being alike, the same as you can't count two PCs as being alike, which means they're going to develop for the lesser of the two, which means you might as well just take the hard drive out of your 360 and throw it away, because the only thing you're going to be doing on it is listening to MP3s while you play games. Hey, don't listen to me. Listen to this guy. He didn't spare any criticism for Sony either, saying that the PlayStation 3 makes my life as a developer much harder. His problem being that all of the sudden with the new platforms, he basically has to figure out how to make games in a way that he nor any of his programmers have ever done before. He said in certain cases, the programming involved in developing for next-gen titles could slow down progress by up to 80 times. He also said that, for example, Sony would make a killing by the fact that in order to program for the multiple SPE-based cell processor, code would become far less portable, and they would see many titles delivered exclusively on the PS3 because of the simple fact that the code would take too much effort to translate to other platforms. He also said that content delivery systems like Steam would do gamers far more good than any of the features built in next-gen consoles and operating systems. You know what? That's where you and I disagree, sir. Steam makes you mega cash, is what Steam does. Steam lets you control everything. That's what you like about Steam. Don't tell me it does more good than upgrading the processor, because quite frankly, it does not. You're bitching at Vista, basically saying that they're not going to solve any problems. Steam doesn't solve any problems either. Steam creates problems, like having to check in to play my video game. We've heard rumbles from developers concerning the next-gen consoles, but Newell has been the most vocal. His concerns will be listened to by many, as Valve are currently one of the most influential developers in the market, though companies like Sony and Microsoft tend to have very thick skins when it comes to listening themselves. Yeah. Well, take a look, folks. Nothing I haven't said before. Oh, here's another pro Nintendo article. Why Nintendo gets it, or why Sony should start trying. It blows my mind that Nintendo has so effectively proven that they get it. How so? The Revolution Controller. What? Yeah, that magic wand thing probably is the future of gaming. And furthermore, in the next-gen launch lineup, it's starting to look like Nintendo is the only company that will ever deliver a truly next-gen gaming platform. Compared to the Revolution, the Xbox 360 and PlayStation 3 are simply expensive upgrades to existing platforms. I'll read a little bit more of this. Nintendo gets it. Microsoft and Sony don't understand that a new generation of gaming machine does not automatically beget a new generation of gaming. A next generation requires a significant change in gaming itself. Gamers care about hardware and hardware generations only insofar as those generations mark major changes in the way games are made and played. Gamers care about frame rate only insofar as frame rate is connected to the limit of the player's reflexes. The interaction of technology and creative expression and experience is a complex terrain, which often is understood in a highly intuitive array of impulses on the part of gamers. This intuitive understanding of the relationship between tech and game leads easily into fetishes of game hardware. Witness the hip NES controller belt buckles sold in mall shops worldwide or the 360 faceplates. All tech-dependent art forms fetishize, is that actually a word, fetishize? The mechanical aspects of their practice, photography, computers, sports, music. In each case, one can see similar devotion to the objects and implements of the practice on the part of the practitioners. I don't know about you, but none of that made much sense to me. Anyway, there is some good stuff in here, though. I did read the article through. It just doesn't sound right reading it aloud. But take a look at this, and what's really funny is, just so you guys know, I didn't read this stuff before I did my rant. I purposefully do not read user submissions or listener submissions, and I purposefully do not go out on my own to obtain gaming information before I do my editorial commentaries, because I want to go at those completely with what I've got in my noggin. And so it's kind of funny when I go back and start reading some of these articles that you folks have sent in, and it talks about something that I've just been talking about. So anyway, check that out. Interesting article. Video game ads, classic, contemporary, and present video game TV commercials. This is an archive of tons and tons of commercials for video games, old and new. You know, and I swear I promoted this last month, but the system didn't tell me there was a dupe, so what can I tell you? Maybe I promoted it twice. Flair, I'm sure, will tell me later on. Okay, man, there's still so much to look at. How would you like to be prosecuted for refilling your ink cartridge? That's what Lexmark has managed to do. According to the Ninth Circuit ruling this week in the ACRA versus Lexmark, opening the package means you agree to Lexmark's wishes. Because Lexmark printer cartridges say one use only or single use only on the box, if you refill it, you are actually guilty now of a crime. Yeah. Wow. So basically, if Coke wants to, they can say something on the box or something on the packaging that says that I can only pee out Coca-Cola in Coke-approved toilets. And that technically should be legal. What's that all about? Anyway, this is a good article. It's got some legalese in it, but what the hell? The copyright... People have lost their minds. Didn't I say last month people lost their minds? People have lost their freaking minds. Peripherals galore. Here's some more Revolution stuff. I just keep getting sent this stuff, folks. I don't go out and find this stuff. This is what people send me. This is a new website basically devoted solely to keeping tabs on the Revolution. I'm going to give you a link to not only several articles that made a lot of sense to post, but also the main homepage, which is what I'm looking at right now. Worth looking at if you are a potential Revolution fan. What else do I got here? 8-Bit Weapon wrote in and said that their new album is shipping. Vaporware Soundtracks. composed and performed using some fun toys like vintage video game consoles, including classic Nintendo, Game Boys, Commodore 64, and 128, synthesizers, old electronics, and a live drum set. It features over an hour of original tunes inspired by the music from old 8-bit video games, as well as electronic music from the 70s and 80s. For those of you wondering who these guys are, these are the ones that play over my interviews every year. So if you've listened to the interviews where you can't hear me or the other people, that's these guys. Actually, you know, it's not their fault. It's just a more a matter of location, proximity, and bad communications. But the music's good. Their album, I think, runs, $14.99? And get this. This is actually kind of cool. It comes in a 5.25-inch floppy case. The disc is black, so it actually looks like a floppy disc. Go to the site and take a look at it. It'd almost be worth it just to have the case. Very cool. Anyway, only 500 copies of this limited edition version of the album were made and are hand-numbered and packaged inside of an old 5.25 floppy disc. Anyway, so check it out. Very cool. 8-bit weapon, good music. At least somebody's trying to keep the spirit alive of old 8-bit music. Good stuff. I think I had them last month and I forgot to run it, so my apologies to that. Thinking outside the cube. Is originality in video games dead? Well, this talks a little bit about, it's definitely more of a pro-Nintendo thing, but it's got some interesting information. It's from allcube.com. So check it out. I mean, there's a lot of pro-Nintendo stuff going around. It's kind of inspiring. But I got so much of this stuff that, oh my God. All I got to do is send you to these guys' site, nesbuckle.com. We just mentioned a few minutes ago about people buying belts with video game controllers as the belt buckle. Now, the NES controller is one thing, but this guy has got an Atari 2600 joystick sticking out of his pants. You know this? The only thing I can think of is Sex Machine from Dusk Till Dawn. Because that's what this guy looks like. He looks like he's got his 2600 wanger sticking out at you with a red button next to it. This is some of the funniest things ever. At least they do have a little tongue-in-cheek on here. The Atari controller is something that should never have been turned into a belt buckle. For this reason, we had to make it. Wear it for instant nostalgia and be the hit at your next party or crowded subway. More likely, you'll get a lawsuit on your next crowded subway. But check it out. NESbuckle.com. Unbelievably insane. Now, here's something that really brings total insanity to mind. Somehow, when you think of the term Emmy Award, you think about television programs, right? Emmy Award-winning Family Guy. Emmy Award-winning... what's another show that wins Emmys? Who cares? Emmy Award-winning Family Guy. You think about television shows. Somehow, Xbox Live got an Emmy Award. Recognizing groundbreaking work in television broadcast and production systems, interactive television, and other new media technologies. How the hell do you... Who got paid off for that? I don't care whether you love Xbox Live or don't love Xbox Live. To put an Emmy for Xbox Live is nothing short of embarrassing, humiliating, being caught with your hand in the cookie jar, paying somebody off $20,000 to put them in the running. That is absolutely the biggest load of crap I have ever heard in my life. This far and exceeds all the crap I heard last month. Xbox Live gets an Emmy. The Classic Computing and Gaming Show. This is being held in Ohio this December. The National Guard Armory in Lorain, Ohio. Absolutely free to vendors and attendees. So for those of you who have not managed to make it to a Classic Gaming Expo, the California Extreme, the Philly Extreme, or one of the other 10 billion classic gaming and computer shows, if you're stuck in Lorain, Ohio, you can go to the Classic Computing and Gaming Show. The show has been recently rescheduled, so for those of you who have it on your calendar, please make sure you get the update. I guess I shouldn't be mean, should I? That's not nice at all. Someone trying to support classic gaming. One of the committee members is a member of the National Guard, and they needed the the change of time. But they've apparently had one of these for the last, 4 years. 5 years, it looks like. So, hey, this could be okay. So check it out anyway, especially if you're anywhere in the area. A lot of people have problems getting over to Las Vegas and all the other places. Well, you know, do what you can. Support classic gaming. I just think it's funny. It's Lorain, Ohio. I don't know. Anyway, check it out. The Classic Computing and Gaming Show. Take a look. Whew. Boy, it just seems like the stuff just doesn't end this month at all. Now, see, a lot of people say now that video gaming is expensive. It costs way too much money to make games. It takes too many people, too much time. And that's why we can't get any quality gaming, is because it costs too much money. There's nobody willing to take risks, etc., etc. This article, How to Build a Game in a Week from Scratch with No Budget, from Rampart Games. They built an RPG in 40 work hours using nothing but free software to create it, making it a 100% cheap project. The rules for this were a limit of one work week defined as 40 hours, all free tools, no engines, only basic libraries and API. So basically you can get yourself a Telengard slant Temple of Abshai style game for free. Made for free, given away for free. This is a fascinating article. I totally recommend that anybody who's even remotely in game design, game development, interested in software pricing, all that good stuff, this is a great article. I really recommend you pick it up and check it out. What else do we got? Dissecting California's Violent Video Game Bill. This is another one of those articles that talk about what the next big step is for California in terms of banning video games. Let's see. The bill brings into focus and, more importantly, actually probes some of the two more serious issues facing the industry. Above all else, examining and dissecting the proposal reveals some truly frightening facts. Part of the reason for writing this article is to alert readers who have merely brushed this bill off, and even more for those who actually applaud it. If passed, AB 1179 would fine retailers up to $1,000 per violation if they were to sell a game deemed safe for adults only, that's in quotes, to someone under the age of 18. Let's see here. What's some of the really scary stuff? Let's see. Countless studies have proven that video games, an interactive form of entertainment, are exponentially more damaging to the mind and body than, say, the latest action flick. This is, I'm assuming, quoted from the bill. Let's see. It goes into the whole bill analyzation. I don't want to get into it because I couldn't do it justice even if I did. But take a look at this stuff, folks. People have really lost their minds. I mean, Big Brother, man. I mean, what else can you say but Big Brother? Well, here's that other Japanese game I promised to talk to you about. I'm not even going to give you the Japanese game name. It's called Cave Story in English. Freeware side-scrolling platformer. They also made that other game I was telling you about. Anyway, there's now a full English version, and it's free. Leaning towards Wonder Boy and recent side-scrolling Castlevania titles. So that kind of gives you an idea what sort of game it is. I have not played it. I'll just pass it along. CEO of Ubisoft couldn't stop EA takeover. The stock of French publishers gain after... there's another language I can't pronounce. Guillemont says that he'd sell for the right price. When you know your company has spent months in takeover crosshairs of acquisition-hungry industry giant Electronic Arts, you shrug it off. In a remarkable display of corporate sang-froid this week, the Ubisoft CEO admitted his company would be powerless to stop a hostile EA takeover, and he wasn't very worried about it. Quote, "We are not safe from a hostile action from Electronic Arts, which it would be difficult to block if they make a genuinely interesting offer. But we have a few elements allowing us not to be too nervous." Among these protecting factors, he cited about how the Paris-based publisher clearly demonstrated its value to industry players, meaning any takeover bid would not come cheap. "I doubt that our shareholders would be won over by a price cut. However, just because Ubisoft won't sell low doesn't mean it won't sell. If somebody's interested in our company advantages... or in our competitive advantages, and this person is willing to pay for those at the right price, then we will choose what is best for our shareholders and our employees." Interesting to see somebody who doesn't care about Electronic Arts. Good for you guys, right? One Up yet again funnels us another article here. EGM's countdown to 2000 continues with, or issue 200 continues with top 10 bosses. Top 10 bosses of video games. Mike Tyson from Mike Tyson's Punch-Out clocks in at number 10. Stage 3 in R-Type clocks in as number 9. DeRole from Phantasy Star Online, whatever, clocks in at 8. Ninja Gaiden's Alma clocks in at 7. Resident Evil 3's Nemesis clocks in at number 6. Gunstar Heroes 7 Force at number 5. Metal Gear Solid 3, this is retarded, why am I reading this list? The End. Mother Brain from Super Metroid, number 3. Metal Gear Solid Psycho Mantis is number 2. And Final Fantasy VI, Sephiroth. Yeah. Well, I don't even know why I bother reading this crap. Let's move on. PlayAsia is advertising the new Dig Dug Digging Strike game for the Nintendo DS. Looking like a cross between Dig Dug and Dig Dug 2. Looks like it might be a nice little taste of classic gaming for us Nintendo DS people. Anyway, you can check it out. Hey, it's Dig Dug, man. Who doesn't like Dig Dug? Sega goes gold with Taito, or goes old school with Taito. I don't know why I said gold. Creepy. Taito Classics will be published by the house that Sonic built. Collection includes Space Invaders, Bubble Bobble, and many other games. A list of all 29 games is going to be available for $20. Let me run the list of stuff. Battle Shark, Bubble Bobble, Colony 7, Continental Circus, Electric Yo-Yo, Elevator Action, which gets a thumbs up from me. Exesis, Gladiator, Great Swordsman, Jungle Hunt, another fingers up. New Zealand Story, Ninja Kids, Operation Thunderbolt, Operation Wolf, which could be cool. Phoenix, thumbs up. Plotting, Plump Pop, Rainbow Islands, Rastan gets thumbs up. Return of the Invaders, Space Gun, Space Invaders Part 2, Super Kicks, Thunder Fox, Tokyo, Tubit, Volfied, thumbs up. And Zookeeper, can you believe it? Zookeeper, finally in a home version for a console. Bravo, $20. Let's hope the PlayStation 2 version doesn't suck. Yeah, here's an interesting idea. I'm wondering how these guys get away with it. NES Cafe allows you to play Nintendo games right inside your browser. Once again, one of those things that I bet Nintendo just doesn't know about. But anyway, check out NES Cafe and play Mike Tyson's Punch-Out for free. And then wait for your letter from Nintendo to come. Virtual game Tringo makes the leap to reality. So basically, somebody made a web game and it got picked up for publishing. Yeehaw! Doesn't even look like that great of a game. Who knows? Could be cool. I'm just saying it doesn't look like that great of a game. Anyway, read the article if that sounds of interest to you. Nice article on the Sid Meier legacy. Of course, the guy that brought us, Civilization, etc. I mean, you know who Sid Meier is. I've already talked about him at length. Anyway, another good article about that guy. We mentioned the spectacular rise and fall of Commodore, a big historical look in a book format about the Commodore 64 and Commodore in general. Apparently, it's now shipping. I'll give you a link to that. Anybody who's interested in Commodore's history, I'm sure, would find that fascinating. Hey, now here's something I'm actually going to stop and talk about. You old Commodore 64 heads probably remember Quantum Link. Basically, AOL before AOL became AOL and began to suck. Quantum Link was the first media-rich online service. Basically, you would take a disk, stick it in your Commodore 64, you would connect, and using colorful graphics, intuitive, easy-to-navigate menus, and all this other stuff, you could access Quantum Link, download files, chat in multiple chat rooms, get the latest information, news. In fact, I got through American history by stealing articles from Q-Link and putting my name on them and submitting them. I used to get like a B-plus out of that, and I never had to write anything. Anyway, Quantum Link, as everyone knows, went away, became AOL, or the people broke up, created AOL, and the rest is horrible history. Somebody has managed to get the software for Quantum Link, the server, and are now running it using an emulator or even a real Commodore 64. You can now log back into Quantum Link, play the games, talk to the people. I was actually chatting in People Connection the other night. Wow. And it's not that hard to set up, folks. It's pretty easy. And you can use an emulator for free. Download the discs right on the site. That's cool. Okay, this is not making a 3-foot Game Boy. This is not making a Game Boy Advance into a web server. This is actually something useful. For God's sake, somebody applaud these people quickly. Anyway, I'll give you a link to that. History of Mario sports games. For those of you who are into Mario and sports games, you'll want to get in on this. They do have some interesting topics about Mario Kart and some of the Virtual Boy tennis, things like that. Good read. Got to be into it, though. Here's another article on understanding the Revolution controller. If you use two pointers, can four people still play? How will the Revolution handle more conventional games? IGN.com, Talk Shop, and interviews. Who'd they interview for this one? Let's see. It doesn't say who they interview. How about that? So who the hell is this guy talking to? Maybe they're just answering user questions. Anyway, good stuff. Some of the questions, what's so special about the controller? Can you give us an example of how it might work in a game? What kind of expansions? What does the conventional controller shell do? Etc., etc. Anyway, check it out. Interesting stuff if you're into the possible forthcoming Revolution. So what is keeping people from using their cell phones to do something more than make calls? Well, you know my opinion. I'm no fan of gaming on cell phones. I don't think it's there. I don't think it's going to be there. And everything will cost you on a per-play basis, not the model that Shane R. Monroe wants to work under. But apparently, the reason that nobody wants to do this stuff is battery life. Mobile phone users rate battery life over sophisticated built-in cameras and video recorders, according to a new study. Topping the wish list of key mobile devices featured in 14 of the 15 countries surveyed is 2 days of battery life during active use, indicating that insufficient battery life is a concern to consumers. It's probably a concern to PlayStation Portable owners, too. Interesting article, barely related to gaming, but I thought I'd slip that in there. Another article about the Nintendo Revolution. I got sent tons of this stuff, folks. It's not just me. Hey, do you remember the couple months ago we were talking about the cash bounty they were awarding for the first person that could TCP/IP hack the Nintendo DS? Well, the bucks are up to $2,000 for the first person that can get the DS homebrew community working with Wi-Fi. Interesting. Keep it coming, boys. You know, you got my support. Somebody sent me a link for something called Supernova Galactic Wars. It's supposed to be a cross between chess and an arcade game. Honestly, I gave it a try, and on my Super Whamadyne P4 3 GHz computer, it was too slow to play in battle mode. Obviously, the chess piece worked out fine, but then again, I don't have a great video card. So, I don't know what to tell you about this game other than the fact that it looks like an interesting concept, but we've seen it before when it was called Archon. This time it's based in space. I don't know. Maybe someone who can actually play the game long enough or far enough and have a decent speed can tell me what it's all about. But I thought this was kind of interesting, and they did generously send a key for me to try out. So, you know, never hurts to bring them up. I will tell you, though, it's too slow for me to run, so your mileage may vary. Hey, remember Shadow Warrior was one of those good old-fashioned first-person shooters back when first-person shooters were still fun. It was made by 3D Realms, same people that did Duke Nukem. This was sort of that Japanese Orient flavor, right? It was a lot of fun. A lot of people liked it. Anyway, apparently there was an expansion pack that was supposed to come out called Wanton Destruction. It never came out. Well, now they're releasing it for free. So if you're a Shadow Warrior fan and actually managed to get it running under Windows XP, good for you. And now you can get the expansion pack for free. Can't complain about free, folks. Revolution controller mock-ups. People have endlessly theorized about what you could do with a Nintendo Revolution controller. And I've already talked about it, folks. I think it's exciting as hell. But this is a site that has a bunch of mock-ups visually on how you could use that controller. Everybody knows I hate TiVo. I hate any market where they double-dip the living crap out of you, right? You buy the hardware, you got to pay to use the hardware. Don't like that. Anyway, good to know for you TiVo people. TiVo 7.2 OS adds content protection, blocks transfers, and auto-deletes some shows. Ha! I recently got a sample of TiVo DRM accidentally, I suspect, Recently, a Simpsons rerun recorded with a red flag next to it, an icon I've never seen before. When I selected the episode, I got a message to the effect of, the copyright holder prohibited saving the episode past this date. I also noted the episode could not be copied using TiVo Togo, but it could be saved to tape. I guess that's the analog hole. I have two comments for TiVo and any other publishers foolish enough to activate this flag. TiVo 1, just because some folks ask for a feature, there's no reason to give it to them. TiVo 2, better treat your subscribers well or you won't have a business. Even your lifetime subscriptions won't protect you when I and many other people decides to switch to an HDTV DVR. To the publisher, go ahead and prevent me from saving your show past a certain date, I dare you. I can't think of a single show I would still watch. I can't think of any quicker way for you to lose my viewership. Anyway, so check it out. If you're really interested in making yourself a PVR, I've got articles on reviews.monroeworld.com that talk about what I use at home. And I ain't got to deal with any of this crap. But anyway, check it out. If you're a TiVo owner, this is what you're in for. Hope you didn't pay that lifetime membership. Sony and Namco settled Pac-Man lawsuit. Remember that little flip song that apparently used a couple of bytes of audio from Pac-Man? The ooh, whoop, that sound on the night or the 2004 double album, You Gotta Feel Me. They settled. Of course, they don't tell us what they settled on. An out-of-court settlement that resolves an intellectual property rights lawsuit brought earlier by Namco. Oh, man. There's nothing safe. I can't throw a little Pac-Man music into a mix. Not even a sound effect. Man, you think people would be kissing somebody's ass for that. But no, no. Let's settle it out of court. Never played Sam and Max myself, but Sam and Max apparently was an incredible game. Everybody loved it, etc., etc. Apparently there's another Sam and Max game coming out. I don't know anything about Sam and Max. I can't help you folks, but I can give you a link and tell you that it's coming. So, worth checking out if you're a Sam and Max fan. The new Amigas video. Before there was a Macintosh, the Amiga was the computer for the creative community. This program looks at the Amiga 2000, the 500, Photon Video Cell Animator, Music X, Video Toaster, and Interceptor, originally broadcast in 1988. Hey man, free Amiga, free Commodore Amiga movies? Sign me up. Check it out. I'll give you a link. Now, here's something that never quite made sense to me. There's two parts to this not making sense. A train simulator. Now, I understand. I can understand a city sim, right? I can understand a Sim City. I can understand Sim Earth, Sim Life. I buy into a lot of that stuff, right? I mean, it's a niche market, you know. Zoo Tycoon, roller coaster, theme park management. I buy all that, but the concept of building railroads or a train simulator. I understand model railroading. I've never got into it. I've known some people that were into it. I understand model railroading. I understand how pleasing that could be. But to build it on a screen for some reason doesn't seem to have the kind of appeal. You know, having the little miniatures exactly the right size and looking accurate. You know, there's something to model railroading that makes sense, but Microsoft's train simulator didn't ever make sense to me. Well, if that didn't make sense, now there's a product called Route Control, which is software designed to make routes for Microsoft Train Simulator. Well, did we need Train Simulator? Now we need a route maker for it? I'm obviously missing something huge here. So someone who's into Microsoft Train Simulator or knows somebody who is, let me know. Drop me a line. I'm really curious about how this works. I don't know. Like I said, I'm probably just missing something. It wouldn't be the first time. I want to be fair, though. I thought I'd bring it up because this is intriguing to me. Why that would be fun. I almost understand a roller coaster simulator, but I don't know if I understand the train thing. Now I know hell's frozen over. The OC, which epitomizes nighttime teen version of Dallas and Falcon Crest, is going to get its own video game. Publisher Gameloft will announce a multi-year license Monday. Multi-year? How long do you think OC is going to be around? licensed Monday with the first game scheduled to launch next year. The hit series of the OC joins GameLoft's collection of Hollywood-related mobile games, including War of the Worlds and King Kong. Reality simulation titles like The Sims is what it's supposed to be like, allowing fans of the show to explore the OC universe. By dressing to impress, joining the right cliques, and dating the right people. So basically, teaching you how to be a bitch. Nice. So now, in case you need brush-up training on how to be a bitch or an ass, you can fire up your cell phone and play OC the video game. Wow, where have I been? This is incredible. Who's promoting this service? I've got to have a phone that supports this, because that just sounds super to me. Nintendolosophy, the non-game. This is another report from that new Revolution site called Revolution Report that I said is actually a pretty good site. Pretty good article about talking about games and what Nintendo's planning on doing. Again, I'm not going to drill endlessly on it, but a lot of this stuff correlates with what I mentioned earlier. Synergy. My goodness. The list just goes on and on. Another Nintendo article, Innovation or Insanity? Hey, another article for you guys to read. It's getting a lot of press, folks. Innovation tends to do that. Now, here's something that I'm almost afraid to promote, but I'm going to have to do it anyway. Super Mario Brothers, or Super Mario World, has been converted into a JavaScript application. Now, before you buy into the hype that it's only JavaScript, it's also ActiveX, which means God only knows what's going to happen to your system after you play this game. In any event, it basically creates Mario Brothers inside your browser. I fired up IE and turned on every piece of security software I had and played it. I got to admit, it's kind of impressive if JavaScript's really a big part of it. My guess is it's a lot more like ActiveX than anything else. So what do I know? Anyway, check it out. Way too funny. Just to see this. It's not even Mario. It's some weird cat thing. But anyway, check it out. Again, turn all your safeties on. I know ActiveX is running in here. So do be careful. PlayStation Portable takes fashionable technology to the next level with an exclusive designer accessory show. A PlayStation Portable fashion show. I'm not sure how to respond to that. Probably like I responded to the Paris Hilton Nintendo DS. WTF, over. Another next-gen biz interviews developers on the Nintendo controller. Now, this is important. I'll sidestep all the other Nintendo articles. Here are what the developers are saying. I don't care what the users are saying. The users are the ones who have to write software for this thing. Let's see if I can find just like one or two good ones in here. I don't want to spend the rest of the frickin' time talking about this. Who's a recognizable face? Epic Games. Here's good. Cliff, I've had to pick the guy with the hardest last name. Cliff Bleszinski, lead designer of Epic Games. It seems as if Nintendo has found a modular way that they can take the best of the location-based entertainment arcade experience and bring it home to the user. So all of the games you love physically interacting with at the arcade, the drum game, the fishing, the poke your friend in the eye one, can really come to life in your living room. I haven't been able to hold or use it yet, so I'll refrain from making further judgment until I get my hands on what on that's what really truly matters, the feel. EGM says it's risky, but it's a smart risk. If Revolution launched with a conventional controller, it would offer competitive graphics in Nintendo first-party games. In other words, it'd be about in the same position as GameCube is in this generation. But now, Revolution may appeal to more casual or non-casual gamers, along with the core gamers who are looking for a genuine new gameplay experience. If Nintendo can really bring out a large chunk of non-gamers into the fold, it would be huge, but that is the big question mark. There you go. Like I said, pretty much what I've already said. Now, let me ask you guys a question. Take the Sony PlayStation Portable. I'm going to go so far as to say it's a movie player that plays video games. You guys can disagree. That's cool. How bad off are you? How bad are things? I'm just saying. How bad are things when you release a UMD movie with an interactive or a video game on the same disc? What is this saying? Does it say that the movie really, really sucks and the only way that we could get you to buy the movie was to pack it in with the top-selling game from the system? Or does it say that the game maybe ain't selling as good as it should? Or does it say that the PSP has totally confused everybody? They don't even know what the hell market they want to own or what they'd like to go for. And so they're playing both sides of the fence, betting, hedging their bets, right? First ever movie game combination UMV features the film Stealth. Well, that explains a lot. Plus three levels of PSP's top-selling Wipeout Pure for movie gaming fans. Now, first of all, they'd like to have you believe that this is like a new deal, this hybrid content thing. You know it's not. So look past that. There's no innovation there. Look at enhanced CDs. Look at... there's all sorts of different technology that's exactly the same deal. This breakthrough UMD... Now, how do you break through something that's brand new? I'm trying to figure that out. Offers users three tracks, three crafts, and three player modes, including a multiplayer option with up to four players. Well, that's nice of them. At least you got a multiplayer mode. The stealth movie plus game combination will allow gamers exclusive access to specially designed stealth crafts from the film, as well as a track not previously available in the pure PSP game. There you go. There's the real hook right there. So, you may not want stealth, but you might want that extra unlockable. So you're going to buy the UMD. You may not give a rat's ass about video gaming on the PSP, but buy the movie, and now they might lock you into getting the game. Yeah, here's the good thing. In addition, the stealth movie game combination includes version 2.0 PSP upgrade with internet browser. Now, they're saying that like it's a great thing. Stealth comes loaded with the newest PSP upgrade, version 2, for consumers to get all the new features possible with their device. And by the way, along with that 2.0 upgrade, they're going to lock out everything that they possibly can to keep you from doing any homebrew stuff on it. Now, I know there's already stuff in development to get around it, but this is starting to sound like work to me. I mean, I flashed my Nintendo DS BIOS. I ain't going to lie to you because I hate that health and welfare screen. But you know, I ain't doing that like every week. It looks like people on PlayStation Portables are working. I like that. I don't want to be working while I'm trying to play games. I just thought this was really funny. I mean, I hope that Sony does well with the PSP. I hope they pick a direction and go with it. Because then it could be a truly great device in whatever market it chooses to be in. But pick a market. You know? I'll tell you what, I was inches away. I almost had the guy unlocking the cabinet to get me a PlayStation Portable. I even begged my wife. She said, give us another month to get our finances together, and I'll let you have one. So, it's not like I wasn't planning to get one of these guys. Untold Legends looks leet. I'm just saying that they're pissing everybody off. Developers are even getting pissed. I'm telling you, in a year you're going to be buying movies for this thing, because the developers are all going to say, you know what? Ain't no money in games here. Sony's basically plugging it as a movie player now. I don't know. I'm not going to get into it. I don't want to badmouth PSP the whole time. I'm just saying that there's something seriously wrong going on. And there's a lot of different people to blame. Okay. I've only got a few more things here, people. Then I want to talk about something actually cool. Here's another one-up article that failed to load. Bastards. Oh. I'm glad this reloaded. Okay. So, remember when they were showing off the Xbox 360 graphics at the E3 show this last year, and everybody came home with a Rod Stiffington going out of their minds about how clean everything looked? Well, apparently, Electronic Arts showed off their NFL 2006 for Xbox 360. Now, it turns out that the game doesn't look anything like the video they showed off. Imagine that. How does that work out?
Personally, I find it incredibly funny that people are actually starting to be called out for showing videos of stuff that doesn't exist, vaporware at E3. I don't know, man. Again, I'm starting to get the feeling that there's a distrust coming. Remember how back in the 80s when the video game crash happened, and the whole reason was because retailers weren't trusting publishers, customers weren't trusting retailers or publishers. People keep telling me I'm crazy thinking there's a video game crash coming, but man, the signs are like lit up in neon. You know, Sony's PlayStation, portable problem, its image problem, confusing developers, confusing consumers. Then you've got people like EA, bald-faced, lying to consumers to pre-sell product. I'm at a loss. But I thought all of the fanboys out there that just absolutely love the Xbox 360, despite having never seen one, should get a chance to compare these videos. Okay, enough Xbox and Microsoft bashing. Here's some guy that took a NES, gutted it, and built a PC into it. You know, again, I guess this stuff's cool, but I can't get my hands around why you would want. I mean, I'm like a total Amiga freak. I've never once even considered the concept of gutting an Amiga computer and putting a PC in it, or gutting an Amiga computer and making it into an NES, or none of this ever occurred to me. I don't know. But hey, you know, for those of you who are enjoying this, I've got nothing better to do with my life article set here, feel free to check that out. Now, here's one of these things that I'm terribly, terribly torn between. Have you ever been to a website that has the kind of information you want to share with people and you think that would be beneficial for people to go to, but the site is so bad that all you want to do is make fun of it the whole time that you're talking about it? That is what this Computer Museum in Australia website is. Absolutely the worst page ever. I mean, just look at it. I won't even go into why it's the worst page ever. Then to actually advertise what you made the page with, you know, it just, I'm sorry, the whole thing is a farce to me. But if you can get by this unbelievably horrible website, there are some good things in there. Here's what the first page, which you can barely read, at least the guy had the courtesy to put it on some other backdrop than what the main screen is. TV games from any decade are fun. These few pages show some of the game machines I have squirreled away. This is not a complete list of my collection because I cannot get to all of it. Ultimately, I'd like to open my computer to the public. There's a link where I am with that on this page. A little basic grammar wouldn't hurt you either. Anyway, check it out. Go through the website. Like I said, there's some interesting pictures on here. It's just, you just want to tear your throat out, actually, looking at the site. Okay, the last thing I want to talk about in bits and bytes, and it actually almost deserved a segment on its own, but I don't quite have enough information yet. Chances are likely that this product will become a regular part of Retro Gaming Radio. And, in fact, I may even try to forge an official alliance with this particular product, because, frankly, in today's day and age, this is the product that will set us all free. This is the product that we talk about on the forums. This is the product that we've begged for, we've asked for, and yet, until now, has never really been delivered properly. The product I'm talking about is the GP2X. A lot of people are like, okay, GP2X, go on. A lot of you may remember the GP32, the Game Park 32, the cool yet ambiguous handheld portable that came from Korea. The GP32 had a lot of strengths. It was very open-ended. There were no proprietary things going on. It had a pretty decent processor. I think 166 megahertz processor is what it shipped with the higher-end models. They even had a backlit display version. Overall, it was the right idea, but maybe not necessarily the best specs or the best time to implement, right? Because back then, you know, you're talking about having, you know, the Game Boy Advance is sort of the leading unit, blah, blah, blah. Not a lot of interest in media in the pocket. Well, this is the perfect time to release the GP2X. So in a nutshell, what am I talking about? The GP2X is everything that you want in a portable and nothing you don't want. Let me just give you an idea here. If you go to the website, you can see a picture of it, and you're going to immediately be engulfed in what it is. Let me tell you what their about page says. Okay. To sum it up, it can play games, it can play your movies, it can play your music, it can even view photographs, it can read ebooks, it runs on two AA batteries, and it can do all this in the palm of your hand or on your TV screen. the handheld can be connected to the TV console style. Watch your movies, your DivX XVID movies on the TV. Play emulated classics on the TV. Or you can do them on the 320 by 240 backlit display. And the display looks really great. I'm sure it's mocked up for the page, but it looks really good. It runs on Linux, so it's all free. If you want to develop for this handheld, you're not going to be paying 20 grand for a license from Nintendo. They give you the developer's package with the unit. You can start making games the day you get this guy. Which means anything that runs on Linux can very likely be ported to this guy. And believe me, they're already doing it. I've got some inside information for you guys later on in this segment. It has two 200 megahertz CPUs with 64 megs of RAM. Custom graphics hardware and decoding chips. Takes industry standard SD cards. Industry standard. None of this freaky Sony memory stick crap. It can play movies without any recoding. Let me read that one more time, just because I don't want you guys to miss out. That means it can play any movies without any recoding. No recoding. That means no more making MP4s, no more waiting 20 years to compress video into some special format. You take your video, you drop it to the SD card, you plug it in, and you play it. And it's got a hardware scaler. So you're not going to have to worry about your larger movies looking like crap on this little screen. Not going to happen. Hardware scaling. Now, this means that you can play this on your TV. It's got a TV out. It means you can play it on the go. I'll give you some more specs here in a minute. But I paid $186. I pre-ordered. Comes out the end of October is when they're going to be shipping. $180 for the unit. Well, that's a lot less than the PlayStation Portable, not much more than Nintendo DS, and this guy is ready to be your portable media center. Now, for those of you who, like me, aren't necessarily concerned with having another MP3 player or another video player, what can we look for games here? Well, I'm going to be honest with you. This is not going to be Nintendo DS. This is not going to be Game Boy Advance. You're not going to go down to Fry's or Best Buy and pick up games for the GP2X. Not going to happen. I know everyone would like to see it happen. They're hopeful they can make this mainstream, but I'm going to be honest with you. You can't play in the market space with handhelds at this point in time unless you're Nintendo, unless you're Sony. But this is a whole different deal. This is something for you and me, my friends. This is something for us to play MAME on. This is something for us to play Commodore 64 emulation on. This is could easily run an Amiga emulator. This could run tons and tons and tons of games that are already out there for Linux. There's a huge market available for the GP2X right out of the box. And there's no content restriction. There's no firmware upgrade chasing around. What you do not have in here, just so that there is no confusion, there is no Wi-Fi in here. There is no browsing the internet on this thing. You want to browse the internet, go to an internet machine. Why would you want to browse the internet with a joystick and buttons anyway? Right? I could almost see a touchscreen. Because at least you can have the virtual keyboard on the DS, surf on the top, and then type on the bottom. That kind of makes sense. But anyway, no, I don't want to talk about that. I want to talk about the GP2X. Now, dual CPUs plays any movie pretty much right out of the box. Ready to go for emulation, right? MP3s, photos, ebooks, USB 2 high speed, uses industry standard SD cards, runs on two AA batteries, and they tell you can run 8 to 10 hours. 8 to 10 hours watching movies on two AA batteries. All right. It doesn't matter. If you're a PSP person, or you're even considering a PSP, you should be looking at this unit instead. It's cheaper. Does everything that you guys apparently want the PSP to do. Okay, it doesn't play Wipeout Pure. Who cares? All right, you've got Wipeout on your PlayStation 2. All right, this is going to be the future. If this even remotely works out, like they say it will, and people have even a remote passing interest in porting emulators for it, which they already are, just so you know, all the major emulation authors have already given their support to this guy. And I've talked to Craig over there at GP2X. Good guy. Despite the fact that he's, I'm sure, swamped with emails. The guy took out time to give me a personal email. He's going to send us one of these to review for the show. Chances are likely I'll be able to give it away as a prize or something in the future. But he's already told me, I asked him for a little inside information. And he says, right now, they already have Quake running, and it's amazing. Quake is already running on this guy, and it's amazing. Right? What do you want? He says, next month, he'll be able to give me more information on how the emulation process is going. All the emulators are being converted. He's going to have brand new information for us. So we're going to get info right from the horse's mouth. So this isn't a company that I'm going to write to and get a generic email response from and have to worry about getting information. This guy is open. If you go through the site, you'll see the word Amiga bantied around a lot. These guys are old Amiga people, right? They're old fans. They're old users. If anybody can pull this sort of thing off, it's these guys. And they've got final versions of the unit, pictures to show you, videos, all that good stuff. So I highly recommend, if you have any interest at all whatsoever in playing portable emulation, if you have any interest in a portable media player that doesn't suck, I would definitely recommend you look at the GP2X. And we will be covering more about the GP2X as we get more information here in Bits and Bytes. And once I get the final unit, I'll give you a full review, and we'll talk about how the GP2X practically stands up to the needs of the retro gamer. And I will personally give you the full skinny. I'm going to try the Quakes and the C64 emulators and all that stuff. I'm going to give you the full bore review. And it's $180, folks, with a U.S. distributor. Now, that's a good deal. $180 is not a bad deal for what you're getting. So anyway, enough about the GP2X for this episode, but I wanted to make sure everybody got that. So I think with an hour and 20 minutes into it, I think we're actually going to wrap up this edition of Bits and Bytes. But before, of course, we go, I'd like to talk about who contributed this month to the show. Christian Egler, James Parker, Tim Remo, Nukem Six, Simon Peterson, Adam Kerr, Gary Corcoran, of course, Daniel Greaves, Noel Long, of course, our great Fernando Garcia, a.k.a. Flair, Magnus Anderson, who contributes from time to time. I see his name in the list. Nathan Kozlowski, Jim Graham. Again, if I butcher your names, folks, just write in. I'll let someone know next time. Dave Bulwer, Lion 2, Java Coder, Celso Riva, Stephen Bruce, Tim Allington, Leon Petrus, Cameron Myers, Frederick Schultz, Todd Washburn, Edward Barnes, Greg Howlett, Frederick Schultz, Cryptkeeper, Mark Jindra, yeah, that works out. Alex Dixon, Alex Roberts, who else are some new names on this list? Brian King, of course, ArcadeRestoration.com, Jason Ensign, Sean Gethins. Yeah, please let me know if I pronounce your name wrong. Who else do we got? Okay, that looks like about all the... Oh, Julian Lund is another new name on the list here. And that's about it. I have to go through this whole list here. It just keeps getting bigger and bigger, and we keep getting new and newer and more names on it. So, great stuff, folks. Keep up the good work. If you'd like to contribute to Bits and Bytes, please go to RetroGamingRadio.com, hit the Contact Us link, and please type in the information as we're asking for. It'll help us out a lot. So that's going to wrap up this month's edition of Bits and Bytes. Well, folks, that's going to wrap it up for this edition of Retro Gaming Radio. Special thanks go out to SpeedHost.com for hosting us. Need good hosting service, talk to SpeedHost.com. A special thanks to Craig over at the GP2X website for giving us our insight, and he's going to be giving us tons more good stuff on the GP2X in the future. Thanks everyone who contributed on Bits and Bytes, and special thanks to you, the listener, starting our seventh, eighth year here at Retro Gaming Radio. It's been a wild trip, folks. But that's going to wrap it up for this episode. It's been long enough as it is. Hopefully you enjoyed it. More to come all this year on Retro Gaming Radio. This is Shane R. Monroe saying, until next time, keep it retro.